This is Representative Mark Olson. For the record, I'll call the meeting to order, local government meeting for March 13th, 2006. And we have a quorum. And it looks like Representative Sharon has been building up energy and working really hard. Could you move the minutes?
Move the minutes.
The March 8th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Sharon moves the March 8th minutes for approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved for March 8th. Members, the March 9th minutes, I'm going to, if there's no objection, I'm going to lay those on the table for further work, and we'll have those up at the next meeting. Seeing no objection, they'll be laid on the table. Is Ray Representative Vandeveer here yet? Okay. I'll just check. We have on deck for Representative Vandeveer, Mel Mettler. Okay. Elizabeth Mersko. Okay. Dean Johnson.
Not here.
Okay, so we have two. We have some time concerns. Representative Vandeveer, you missed your bill. That's funny, Representative Vandeveer. Kent Sulem. Okay. All right, Representative Vandeveer, are you ready? Okay. Yes, I am, sir. Representative Vandeveer, do you have somebody to move your bill?
No, I don't.
I will move that House Bill 2867 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Vandeveer, your bill is before us, and you may proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one amendment, Mr. Chair, if you could move that, the A2 amendment, to get the bill in the shape we'd like it in.
Okay, I will move the A2 amendment to get the House Bill 2867, to amend House Bill 2867, get it in the order the author would like it. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The bill is amended. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2867 simply incorporates the town of Columbus. Columbus, if you look in your packet, was designated by Anoka County, and I think that I have the town board chair, Mr. Mettler, here, who can expound on that a little bit and what it meant, that they were designated an urban township by the legislature, and that has particular meaning at that time, gave them powers of a village. With the, I believe, the intent of moving towards incorporation as a city at a later date, and Chair Mettler could expand on that if that would be okay.
That'd be just fine. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Chairman Olson and committee members, thanks for allowing me to come here. I am the chairman of the board of Columbus Township. I recognize a number of you from the meeting that you had up in Lent Township a few weeks ago when you toured around the state regarding this whole situation of annexation. So I assume you perceive there is some interest in emotion attached with this whole issue. Columbus is an urban township. I can't tell you how many years ago it was made an urban township, and I can't tell you all the legal ramifications of it, but there are some that basically we've been operating as a city for 20, 30 years. We have a board that meets twice a month, a planning commission. We have a planner, an engineer, and an attorney. We have a road and bridge advisory board. For all intents and purposes, we've acted like a city. Legally, it allows us to do some things, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you exactly what those things are, but it also probably stops us from doing some things, too. We are certainly in the metropolitan area. We started out years ago, as in most places, as rural on the edges, and the urbanization of the cities has certainly caught up with us. About 8 or 9 years ago, we went to Met Council and petition to be included in the Musa line, 3 square miles of the township, which happens to have Interstate 35. Actually, it's got the split with 35E, 35W, and 35. We were granted that at the end of 99 or sometime early in 2000, so that we could go ahead and hook up to the Musa, to the sewer. That was the main thing that we were involved with. And we worked with Forest Lake, at that time Forest Lake Township, subsequently with Forest Lake. We have a joint powers agreement for putting utilities in the area, i.e. sewer and water. We do have, and we've worked on it now, since we got approval, let's say, in the first part of 2000, we now have sewer in, and it's operating. It's hooked up. We have some users. We have the water installed in portions. It's not hooked up and running yet, but it certainly will be in sometime this year. So we've had a plan that we've been working on. We've finally gotten to the point where we actually have users and have development occurring in the freeway district. Last summer, August to be exact, a small group of property owners on the east side of our district met with the mayor of Forest Lake, and some promises were made by some people, and they got a petition. They had a petition of, I believe, 14 people on the east side of the freeway, and they petitioned to go to Forest Lake, to become annexed to Forest Lake. That subsequently was, two things happened. First of all, it was not accepted by the city of Forest Lake, and it turns out some of those promises were way off base as to what services Forest Lake could provide at what cost. About the same time, we petitioned for incorporation. We've been talking about incorporation for years. The cost of incorporation was a factor. The fact that we didn't have sewer and water was another factor, but we didn't proceed with it. So about the same time, actually about a month later, or right, maybe it was the same month, we petitioned to become a city, and we were challenged by the city of Forest Lake, and they contested it, I think, that which makes it a hostile annexation. Since that time, we've gotten support from our neighbors, except for Forest Lake. We've gotten resolutions of support from Anoka County, from City of Hugo, City of East Bethel, City of Ham Lake, Wyoming Township, and Linwood Township. It's my understanding that there's a chance we can fix the legislation that pertains to us. We're a fairly small target here. There's very few urban townships left on the edge of a metropolitan area like this. We're looking at spending at least $150,000 fighting this hostile annexation. If this can possibly be taken care of legislatively rather than letting it go to a judge and listening to who has the best attorney or who can argue the most forcefully, we're hoping we can prevent that and have it handled at the legislative level instead of the judicial level.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would call members' attention to the resolution from Anoka County, which supports the annexation and the incorporation. And I think, as the chair put it, this would be, no one knows the outcome of court cases, but that this would be, because it's unique with regard to them being an urban township and the other characteristics surrounding it, that this would be a very, I think, beneficial way to move forward easier. But it's pretty rare that you have this kind of support for the incorporation. It was clearly the intent early on in the legislature many years ago when they made these designations that these would eventually, with development, become incorporated. And I believe the town of Columbus, with their activities, with their sewer and water, their commercial development, and where they're at today, should be incorporated. So we would stand for any questions at this point, I think.
Okay. Questions for Representative Vanderveer and the test pirates. Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just an FYI. How many acres are you talking about that's in Columbus? And then as far as your percent of people, or how many people actually live there?
Representative.
Go ahead.
Ms. Mersko, please state your name for the record, please.
Chairman Olson and fellow committee members, my name is Elizabeth Mersko, and I'm the town manager for Columbus. Columbus Township is 48 square miles. And I'm sorry, your second question?
How many people live there?
We have Metropolitan Council estimates our population this year at 4120.
Thank you. That was all.
Thank you. Other questions?
Skelton.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Ada.
Mr. Chair. And Elizabeth, and can you tell me, and Ms. Mersko, can you tell me how many acres are projected to be annexed in this proceeding from by Forest Lake?
Chairman Olson and Representative Scalzi, approximately 655 acres is proposed in the annexation petition to be annexed to Forest Lake.
Other questions? Representative Lanning, and then Representative Groff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I'm understanding the provisions of this legislation and the implications of it. Is it your intent to still be incorporated?
Yes.
And this bill, if we passed it, would not only relate to your urban town, but others that may exist. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, we, as far as we know, there was one impacted township, potentially, and that would have been Empire, but the amendment that we put on earlier describes or excludes townships that have orderly annexation agreements, and with that, with the other definitions, I don't think and that there's other impacted townships. I couldn't say for sure, but it's pretty narrowly drawn, and I doubt that there would be many that would meet the criteria.
I think it would be important for us to know whether this only affects this township or if it in fact affects others.
Perhaps Ms. Dyson or...
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, I do not know. I mean, it's clearly limited to the metropolitan area, and it has the criteria, but I can't answer the question if there's any other urban town in the metro area that might be affected. I just don't know.
Ms. Mersko.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dyson and Representative Lanning, it is my understanding that it would affect three townships in the metro area.
And do you know what those are?
It would be White Bear Township, Columbus Township, and Empire Township.
Representative Bronco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, just my discussions with Representative Van Devere, I just wanted to double-check the information you had just for the record that this will not apply to Empire Township. I tend to care about that because the good folks of Empire Township are in my district.
Representative Van
Devere. Mr. Chair, the amendment that was attached specifically excludes a town that only includes towns that are not a party to an orderly annexation agreement. Empire Township is, and staff has told me that this would exclude them as if that was the case.
Yeah. Representative Van Devere, I wanted to say thank you for bringing it to my attention because I know these things can get kind of complex sometimes, and it would have been awfully awkward for me to explain that I support this legislation not knowing that. So thanks again for bringing it to my attention and for correcting it with the amendment.
Certainly. Representative Pilsgrim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Devere, the other townships that it affects or potentially affects, are they aware of it? I see that you have resolutions supporting your township, but my question is about the others.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hellstrom, I believe if it's White Bear, they are already subject to special regulation, but they would have to want to be incorporated, and I think they already have special legislation that was passed for them some time ago that keeps them, I think, from being subject to annexation, and I'm not totally sure what that arrangement is that they have, and if staff or someone could help, but they did have special legislation years ago, and I don't think that, one, I think they'd have to initiate it and approve it, but number two, I don't think they would be impacted in the same way, because I think that they are exempt from being anybody annexing them. Somebody can add to that. So,
further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question that may have been answered since I was late, and I apologize. Why do you not have a current orderly annexation agreement at this time for the township?
Mr.
Representative.
Chair, I'm being hush because they don't want to be annexed orderly or disorderly. it is their intent to become incorporated.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Dean Johnson, and I'm sorry, it's a common name, so not here under any other pretenses. I had a presentation that I would have made. I think the chairman has covered a lot of those issues. Based on a couple of questions that have come up, according to the Metropolitan Council, there are only three townships within the metropolitan area that are within the Metropolitan Urban Service Area. And that's Empire Township, Columbus, and White Bear. As was mentioned, Empire Township does have an orderly annexation agreement with Farmington. The amendment to the bill would remove them from that consideration. I can't speak to the issues involving White Bear, but they have not been subject to annexation issues for a long time since they're so fully developed.
And to the concerns, I think, behind the questions, Representative Vanderveer or others, if I understand this correctly, there in no way is a mandate put upon any other township, even though it does affect a couple other townships. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. That is the intent.
I mean, it would only affect them at their discretion. Any other questions? That will go to those in opposed to the bill. Prentice so small. Mr. Sulem, did you have anything you need to add, or has everything been covered sufficiently? Besides saying the Township Association's position?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. This bill did not arise from our association. This has been Representative Vanderveer working directly with his constituents, and we're happy to see it. Obviously, it does fall on an issue that we care greatly about. I was just going to clarify that in White Bear, I'm not aware of the special legislation, but they have not had annexation battles there in some time because the township is actually providing services to some of the surrounding areas, and they have just worked it out on their own. But this is not an unprecedented area of law in that the state of Michigan prohibits the annexation of comparable townships in that state. They're called charter townships in Michigan. But there is precedence for this elsewhere in the country, and it's been working quite well there. So we do support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Chip Robinson and Patricia Nauman, Carrie Thurlow, and Craig Johnson. If all of you would be prepared, we could probably take a couple of you at the table at a time. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
My name is Chip Robinson. I'm the city administrator for the city of Forest Lake. I want to thank the committee and the chair for allowing us to testify today. And, of course, the city is currently proceeding through a hearing process for a petition to annexation and an incorporation petition, and the emphasis here should be on a petition to annexation. The city of Forest Lake received a petition from over 50% of the property owners in the town of Columbus to annex to the city of Forest Lake. The property contained in that petition, as Mr. Mettler stated, is that property east of I-35 and contiguous to the city of Forest Lake. In Mr. Mettler's testimony, he stated the petition was not accepted by the city council. It was on a second vote taken by the council. And also the town of Columbus has filed for a petition for incorporation. The two petitions are currently consolidated or moving toward a hearing in front of an administrative law judge on April 24th of 2006. First of all, I would go on record stating that the city is in opposition of House File 2867. The city believes that the current statutes and process in place are adequate to protect the town whose property is being annexed and to safeguard property owners' rights. Having gone through many contested annexation cases, I know the high standards that a city must meet to be successful in the annexation process under current Minnesota statutes. And I really believe that this legislation is takes away from property owners' rights. And an article basically that was in the Forest Lake Press a week ago, Mr. Vandeveer is quoted as saying that that's one of his high priorities in the session is property owner rights. By not allowing property owners to petition for annexation, their rights are removed from petitioning for an incorporation to a contiguous city. Okay. Over the past few sessions, the legislature has been involved in the topic of efficiency in government. The incorporation of all urban towns at seven county metro area will create the need for duplication of not only services but creation of additional job positions that would not have been created if the city would have been allowed to use the annexation process. I believe that this is contrary to the legislature's intent. It is very apparent to me that the author of this bill is trying to circumvent the current law and the fair process that is now in place. Mr. Vandeveer is trying to pass legislation for this specific annexation and incorporation process, and I believe he said that today. Probably one of the more frustrating parts of this bill is that Mr. Vandeveer has not even approached the City of Forest Lake to discuss House File 2867, and which I felt was rather poor on his part. One last thing, there seems to be this perception that annexations are always terrible, a terrible thing that happens to a community. Back in December of 1999, the City of Forest Lake and Forest Lake Township were involved in probably one of the largest, if not the largest, annexation processes that take place in the state. At that time, of course, the ideas of hostile takeovers, hostile annexations was out there in the forefront. 6 years later, I can say that that annexation is probably the best thing that ever happened to the City of Forest Lake and Forest Lake Township. An example of that, if you look at our latest newsletter, if you look at the bottom of the front page, it talks about a Headwaters Forest Lake breaks ground. And this is a new development that the city has been involved in over the past 2 years, which is actually taking place in the former Forest Lake Township. I call it a public-private partnership that the city, county, and the private developer have put together. This development proposes to build it's been approved in this last week, a new county library, a North Service Center, a new transit facility, which is actually being paid for by transit funds. And I believe that this Headwaters project would not have been possible without the annexation of Forest Lake Township by the City of Forest Lake, which was also a petitioned annexation. And I thank the committee for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Representative Vandeveer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple brief responses. First of all...
Representative Vandeveer?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Could you bear with me and allow us to take all the opposing testimony and then...
Certainly.
I think that will expedite things a little better because we're over time. Representative Scalzi.
Yes, I just have a question for Mr. Robinson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say over 50% of the property owners, do you mean, how does that transfer over to the 655 acres? Do you mean over 50% of the acreage would be the same?
No, the property owners themselves.
Okay, so, I mean, there might be 50% of the property owners, they might be one large landowner. That's what I'm trying to get at. So when you look at the 655 acres, the total parcel, approximately how much of a percentage was petitioned by how many owners?
And that's a good point. I believe that the actual acreage owned by individual property owners is more than the 50% of the property owners. So that is correct what you're saying. So there's more acreage than property owners. So there's some large property owners in that area that were not part of the petition.
So they were not part of the petition?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Scully. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities, and have a number of significant concerns about the bill. I actually do not believe it is drafted as narrowly as some are reading it to be drafted. To start with, in the metropolitan area, as defined in statutes 473.121, which is the seven-county metro area, there are 47 townships, not three. I understand that the intent was to focus this in on the Columbus Township situation, but this bill is drafted much more broadly than that. I don't entirely understand the new language in the amendment that adds the phrase or is involved in an orderly annexation agreement. We have a number of townships that had orderly annexation agreements, but it might be for a very small parcel of land that's being done over a period of time. And this bill would then say, apparently, that if you have any orderly annexation agreement going on, you're exempt from the entire bill. But let me go through what I had on the bill as comments, because I just saw the amendment for the first time this morning, or just now. As was already mentioned, the state does have a very lengthy and thorough process for evaluating criteria for all of these instances, whether it's a contested case annexation, as this committee has heard many hours of testimony on already in the process, whether it is an incorporation request by a township. There is a specific process for accomplishing that and a list of criteria that the state must order that final conclusion, either incorporation of a township or annexation of an area, if those criteria are met. This bill goes actually a lot further than just dealing with incorporation, however. The sections 2 and 3 deal with section 2, contested case annexation, and says that the state cannot make a finding in a contested case annexation in support of annexing, regardless of the criteria, if it's in the metropolitan area and is an urban town. And in fact, the amendment actually loosened the definitions to say that including sewer or water and other urban services, which are not defined in state statute. So theoretically, you could have a township that is providing a contract for deputies to come through and do police work, maybe has an ambulance contract with someone, and that's urban services, so they now can't have any sort of annexation happen. This also specifically, and related to the last testimony you heard, ends the use of annexation by ordinance, which is typically an individual property owner of 60 acres or less asking to have their property attached to a city that they're adjacent to. This would make it so the state could no longer allow those annexations within the metropolitan area. I think this has the potential to affect a great number of townships. In particular, once an orderly annexation has been completed, a township would then no longer be exempt from, or be, it's hard to use the right words with this, Mr. Chair, because it exempts the state from doing things. Once a township had completed, and a city had completed their orderly annexation agreement, the township would lose, or the city would lose the applicability of this bill, and they would then not be able to do any annexations at all in that township, unless it was an orderly annexation. The final thing, Mr. Chair, that this really does exacerbate is we have a great number of communities right now that are concerned about the settlement fees, the impact fees that townships are adding on top of other recovery of costs and tax-based sharing that happens in an orderly annexation agreement. Essentially, there is regularly now a request for a cash amount per acre on top of whatever other settlement is made for an orderly annexation agreement in order to get the cooperation of the township to sign the orderly annexation agreement. Since this bill would essentially, in the metro area, get rid of any option except an orderly annexation agreement, it would give them an even greater ability to ask for exorbitant amounts of money that right now requests range from several hundred dollars an acre to over $700 an acre just as a fee for an orderly annexation to be agreed to by a township. This would definitely increase their ability to do that. Mr. Chair, I think we have a number of concerns about this bill and how broadly it would affect the metropolitan area, what types of development impacts it might have. Would encourage you to hold off on this, include these discussions as part of an overall discussion of annexation policy. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, I'm curious. You began your testimony without an established certainty that it does apply to more than the townships referenced by Representative Vandegrift and the testifiers, but yet your comments
continually referred to it as applying to much or if not all of the urban townships in the metropolitan area. And given that there's some question there, and I just have the council on it, I'm concerned about what you're saying. It doesn't fit.
Chair, I'd be glad to clarify. There are 47 townships in the identified area that this bill covers. If any of them did not have an orderly annexation agreement going on at a given time, they are included in the coverage area of this bill. So the only ones that, because of the amendment, are not included are ones that have an orderly annexation agreement that apparently is in process somehow. If it is intended to be that all townships that have ever done an orderly annexation agreement are exempted, I don't have data on how many that would be. But there are 47 townships in the identified area of this bill.
And, Mr. Johnson, you don't know how many have orderly annexation agreement?
No, Mr. Chair, I do not.
Okay. I'm seeing other heads shaking in the audience, so I won't ask. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please. You may proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm here representing the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. Basically would echo the concerns of Mr. Johnson. Our organization has strong concerns about this bill, and we believe that current law does provide for an orderly annexation process, that essentially this bill would usurp that process. It's pretty easy to obtain 100 signatures to start that process going, but under current law, that's the start of the process, and under this bill, that would basically, once you have those 100 signatures, you would essentially be forced to incorporate and the annexations would be prohibited. So we would have strong concerns that this bill does usurp the orderly process that is in place in current law and would urge you to act very cautiously. We don't. I would agree that there is potentially a much broader impact of this bill on other metro area townships and would urge your caution in moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thurlow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm here representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And I join both the League of Cities, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, and the Minnesota Association of Small Cities in opposing this bill. Mr. Johnson outlined some of the concerns specifically with this bill, and we would join those concerns. But the coalition's concern, because this bill is tailored particularly to the metro area, is kind of the broader policy implications in passing this bill. We see significant concerns with having the legislature pass special legislation that would prevent a hearing before an administrative law judge on a case that has been initiated. No matter how your feelings are about the administrative law judge process or the process before that with the municipal board, there has always seemed to be a consensus that there should be a neutral party reviewing cases when townships and cities cannot come to an agreement on annexation issues. This particular bill would circumvent that process, and we would join the other city organizations in urging caution, and I ask you whether you really want to invite parties every time there is an initiated contested annexation if you really wish to make this committee the arbiter of all those contested annexations. I think that there's a potential of opening the floodgates and having more special legislation come forward in the future. Again, we would urge caution for these issues to be addressed in a larger bill, but those are the concerns we have specifically with this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Vandeveer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple things, of course. The shrill horror and disorder promised if this legislation passed is kind of consistent since I've been on, used to be on the local government committee, and in some ways the city organizations haven't changed. But first of all, I would like to start with a comment relating to whether this Forest Lake was notified. They were. I talked to the mayor for an hour in my kitchen about this. I talked to two other council members and said if you'd like me to come in or like to talk about this any further, just let me know. So, you know, that statement simply isn't true if that was a concern. Also, with regard to the property rights, five of the 14 petitioners have since withdrew because from the petition with the feeling that they were misled in signing it. But I do have an attorney here, and it's also the opinion of others in the room that the statement that this applies to 47 townships is just simply not true. So if I think the township would like to come back up, and also Columbus's attorney.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bill Griffith. I'm the town attorney for the town of Columbus. A couple of quick points. One is, under the legislation that dates back to 1963, the cities and towns within Anoka County have a special status. The towns prior to incorporation were treated as villages. And so I think if the focus was narrowed to affect the towns in Anoka County, I think many of the comments that preceded my testimony would go away. The other thing that I'd like you to focus on, if you would, members, is the fact that we have a joint powers agreement with the city of Forest Lake. We entered into a joint powers agreement with the town of Forest Lake before it was taken over by the city to provide orderly services to the freeway district. And that agreement is founded on statutes that prefer cooperation between communities rather than conflict and challenge. And so that joint powers agreement was a necessary legal instrument by which we provide services now to our freeway district. That's 10 years in the planning and legal documents that have long preceded this this current challenge. In other words, the services are provided, the horse is out of the barn. Basically, the city has been on record as saying they see the value now of this tax base and they'd like to acquire that. But essentially, the statutes that provide authority for this joint powers arrangement and agreement prefer cooperation, and that's just what we thought we had until this challenge. So this is a very narrow issue. We have urban town powers going back to 1963. We have special legislation in Anoka County providing a village status, which is essentially a precursor to becoming a city. We now have public water and public utilities, and if the focus of this discussion would be on that, then all of the comments that you heard from the league and I believe the association would be for naught. So I'd ask the committee to focus on that narrow discussion in your deliberations.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about what I heard from the league's perspective and the city's perspective, only because we are talking about annexation issues, and we are going to talk about whether or not there is a committee bill coming forward, and I don't want to have every annexation in the state coming before this local government committee. I have no intention of being an arbitrator between groups that are fighting over it. So my question to you, Mr. Chair, is how do you foresee that this is separate from the other larger annexation discussions that we're going to be having later? I know it deals with a specific issue in a specific area, but so does every annexation issue that we have. I'm worried about, you know, preempting a process that we've put in place while we're discussing whether or not we ought to keep it. And if this committee decides that we're not going to keep the process, then I can see stopping all annexations that are going on through the process. But we haven't made that decision, and so weighing in on a particular annexation issue concerns me very much, given the broader discussion we're going to have.
Representative Hillstrom, this bill came forward early. In fact, it was one of the first bills able to be scheduled. And given our time constraints early in the process, we had to schedule bills that we could get in order to use our committee time properly and wisely. The committee determined to hear this bill, not just me. And my understanding, when I considered it, was that it was truly a narrow scope of a bill, and it would not conflict with the annexation debates that we'll have. I still don't necessarily see that it will, and it's up to you and the rest of the members to make that determination when considering this bill. Other questions? Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, hopefully my points might also address Representative Hillstrom's concerns, because what I want to point out is while technically it is true there are 47 townships that qualify as urban in the metro area. If you read the rest of the bill, it specifically says it has to be an urban town in the metro area providing the following services. And that's what brings it down to the three, one of which is actually now down to two, because with the amendment that they're not participating in the orderly agreement process means it's Columbus and White Bear, because the others, to the best of our knowledge, the best of our research, and apparently confirmed by Met Council, the others are not providing the full level of services required. With that, I can only tell you that it certainly is not our association's desire to have every single annexation brought before the committee. That doesn't serve our membership very well. As I said, this was not an association bill. We certainly remain very committed to working with the committee, to working with our city counterparts, trying to address the broader issue. But this bill is very narrowly tailored if you look at the qualifying criteria. So I can only speak for myself and my association. We fully intend to remain at the table and try to solve the bigger issue, and don't see that as being impacted by this legislation.
Representative Vandeveer, if it was found, and by those from the opposing view, that this goes beyond the two additional townships that have been referenced here, are you amenable to language that would make it absolutely certain that it does not do that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. In fact, there was, when it was being drafted, I wanted to just say Columbus Township, but there was some, I don't know, we don't like to do that kind of a thing, and I agree with it generally, and I agree with the process generally. I'm familiar with the annexation process. I don't agree that it doesn't need some work, that it has some tendencies and outcomes that are not always desirable and that make it somewhat unpredictable, and I'm glad to see the committee's working on it. We have no intent of blowing that up or interfering with it, but this is quite unique, and if between here and the time legislation comes up, there's a way to deal with any concerns there are that this is too broad, I'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you, Representative Vandeveer. And in addition to the concerns that Representative Hillstrom so rightly raised, as Representative Vandeveer and Mr. Sulem were responding, Representative Hillstrom, I realize that this really, I feel this really is good to have come up before we do a committee bill, because I think the fact that this bill is here lends credence to the concern that we really do need to look at annexation and address it, or we will, without annexation reform, have a lot of bills like this before this committee. Because I think there's good evidence in what's been presented here that they should be able to incorporate and move forward. They have a long history of providing these services, and that's the reason I've taken the personal position I have, the individual position I have on the bill. And your concerns are valid, and they're welcomed, and I appreciate that. But as I think about what I've just heard and the concerns you've raised, I think it's really good that we have this before we have our annexation debate, because we could see a lot more of this. Other questions? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that under this current legislation that, you know, once again we're seeing another case in which there's some infighting between our towns and our cities in which we don't have orderly annexation agreements. And in so many of the cases that we've heard throughout the state, that has been the consistent story that we've heard, is that these problems are coming out because we have not had orderly annexation agreements and there has not been cooperation in trying to define an urban growth area. This, I think, is only going to make things worse. This is going to encourage, I believe, more people to not be in orderly annexation agreements, or if they are currently in an orderly annexation agreement, that they'd let those expire so they may be able to fall under this current language. So I think it's going the wrong direction. Absolutely. We need to encourage more cooperation, more orderly annexation agreements, and not encourage people getting out of those agreements. So I think people should realize that.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have concerns very similar to Representative Hillstrom's, and in terms of the process. And I guess this bill really addresses several of those 31 questions I think that you sent around earlier. And my question, Mr. Chair, is what do you intend to do in terms of this committee bill process from here on out? I mean, is there going to be something in front of us? And because it does seem that Representative Hillstrom makes an excellent point that if this bill you know, it could incorporate those. Maybe there's some provisions in the committee bill that would be different from this. But this is larger annexation policy. So what are your thoughts about that?
Representative Hornstein, the committee bill is not formed yet, and it's a process that we're attempting. And it's my intention by the end of the week to have something to pass around to members. We've already moved it back to the middle of next week, probably on Wednesday. But it's my intention to have something for members to look at by the weekend. And as far as the members who have conflict and concern with this bill, it's entirely up to you what you want to do with that. It's by mere circumstance that we had this bill early. I don't want to belabor the point. If members want to take action to hold this up, you can do that until we do the annexation bill. But out of courtesy to all those who testified, I think it's very, very important that we finish that for all those who are here. And I actually hope we can move this forward. I believe it is a very narrow scope. I'm trusting it's a very narrow scope. And in that respect, I don't think it is major policy, at least not the kind of major policy that is bad for annexation, a bad annexation policy. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vandiver.
I do have a suggestion. I don't hope this doesn't make it a little more complicated. I don't think it would. What if we just added something that on line 112, the town is an urban town located in the metropolitan area defined in section 473.121 and put on the date of enactment and that would stop. I think it would address maybe Representative Hodge's concerns that there is some policy change here.
Representative Vandiver, can you reference page and line?
Yes. Page 1, line 13, strike the word and insert on the date of enactment and.
Okay. Is that it, Representative Vandiver?
Yes.
Would you like that amendment moved, Representative Vandiver?
Yes.
The chair will move on page 1, House File 2867, on line 13, strike the word and, or delete the word and insert on the date of enactment and. Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandiver, the A2 amendment had already dealt with the and part of it, so staff can work out the grammar with that, but I was also wondering, do you want to make the same change in each of the sections or only on the incorporation?
Representative Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, if the members would be, if it would make it more narrow, we could go with all of the sections if the committee would be happier that way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
I don't mean to belabor this point, and I'm just going to say this last thing, and then I'm going to stop on this issue. I really think that right now we are weighing in as if we are administrative law judge and law judges in determining whether or not annexation should take place in this community. I have never weighed in on whether or not a particular property ought to be or ought not to be annexed, and what you're asking me today is to weigh in on whether or not it's the right thing to do or not. I don't think it's the right thing to do, especially given the process that we're going to have. If we continue with the bill, I'll be voting no. I hope other members will vote no as well. I think it's not the right thing to do. So I hope that we can either lay this over for further discussions, or again, I think it's the wrong thing to do.
I understand from our different perspectives, Representative Hillstrom, and I'm not going to belabor the point either, but I hope members see that we need annexation reform. I really hope we see that, because this is not orchestrated pressure coming from the communities. This is very real pressure coming from the communities. And I think they've given us very good evidence that they should be able to continue with this process, and they're concerned about losing that.
So there's something wrong in annexation. I think that was very evident in our hearings, and I think it's very good that this bill is coming forward before. Now, if Representative Vandeveer would like to hold this bill over, Chair is open to that?
No. Mr. Chair, unless that would be your desire, I would prefer to pass the bill on. If there is concerns and if the those in opposition would like it before it's taken up on the floor to be more narrowly defined than it is, we'll be happy to do that. And that's a promise.
Representative Vandeveer, we need a decision. We have an amendment before us. Representative Scalzi, we're running out of time.
Yeah, and I'll make this quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems though we have a deadline here. I don't know if any of these parties have done this because of the deadline, but if I were Forest Lake, I'd be disagreeing quite vocally, because I'd rather go to this hearing. Because as current law exists, they may have more of a chance. I mean, Columbus Township has been working for quite some time to put this in place to provide the services. So if we didn't have this deadline of this hearing date set, it would be a different thing. But we know how these things tend to drag on and on and on, including how we're addressing eminent domain. I think there's some reason for action on this.
Well, Representative Scalzi, the related point to what I've been saying in response to Representative Hillstrom is that the underlying issue here is, should cities always have annexation power, and should townships never really be able to incorporate and become a city?
You're right, Mr. Chair, and that's what I was getting at.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, you don't understand. Okay, I'm just saying that the way the law currently exists, it would give great credence to the city, and here's a township that's trying to incorporate and has provided the services. And if they have to wait and we don't take care of this annexation reform before they come up to their hearing, it could all be for naught for them.
Okay. Representative Schwann? No? Other comments?
Mr. Chair, let's withdraw the amendment and then just, between here and the floor, if it needs to be more narrowly defined, however narrow you want it, that's how narrow it will be.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Planning. We're going to take a vote here, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Even if we were to narrow this down, mm-hmm. I think we're still setting precedent.
Mm-hmm.
And, for us to short-circuit the process, I think, is a policy question we need to carefully consider. And with respect to, as I understand it, currently there are 46 urban towns. Is that correct? As of this date?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to answer that?
Sure.
There are 47 towns that are within the boundaries that could qualify. However, they do not have urban town status just by that eligibility. They have to take certain actions in order to acquire urban town powers. There are three towns that are affected. One has been excluded. So this is essentially affects two towns, White Bear Lake Township and Columbus.
Well, I guess my point still stands that even narrowing this down, I think we are setting a precedence here that in sort of short-circuiting our review of the whole annexation law.
Very quickly, Mr. Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be very brief. Two things to the section where the amendment was being considered and withdrawn. That section of statute simply describes the seven-county metro area. It does not describe urban towns.
Mr. Johnson, that is withdrawn, so...
The section, Mr. Chair, the reason I bring it up, because urban towns is not a thoroughly defined term in statute. Actually, in Chapter 368.01, it defines powers of certain metropolitan area towns and just says all they need is more than 1,200 people and to be within 20 miles of a city hall of a city of the first class. So that does include a vast majority of the townships in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. That's where our concern is. There are a number of different statuses that townships can be given. One is to be actually called an urban town others are to have the same powers given in other parts of statute, and that does occur in several places in statute.
Representative Vandiver, final comment.
Real quickly, I think that this demonstrates that the concern isn't really the narrowness of the drafting, because we've already said we'll get that down and taken care of. So I think that what the concern may be that one square foot of annexable land might get away. But at any rate.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion on the bill as amended, the chair renews his motion that House Bill 2867 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
I'm going to try this one. The motion prevails. The bill is passed and be sent to the General Register.
Division.
Division being called. Thank you. All those in favor of the motion, you guys count. All those in favor of the motion signify by raising your hand. Those opposed to the motion signify by raising your hand. Okay, we have 8, 4, and 9 against. The motion does not prevail. The bill will not be sent to the General Register. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank you for pursuing this. It's the first time I actually got to vote on this issue instead of talking. I'm talking. I feel good even though I lost, we voted on the dang thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Van Buren, and all of you who testified. The members, I really do hope, I didn't think of this before. Representative Hillstrom and Representative Hornstein's points were very good, and I really hope we see from this that we really have some issues with annexation and we need to deal with them. So an added point to the annexation committee bill is that we're trying to get a committee bill, but all the bills out there are active. And if the committee bill process doesn't work, we will be taking up those other bills. So I want members to realize that. We're going to take action on annexation one way or the other. Okay? Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I move House File 2846 for consideration and passage in referral to the Agriculture Policy and Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Garofalo moves House File 2846 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ag Policy Committee. Is that correct?
That's where it's supposed to go, I guess.
Was there an amendment, Representative Johnson?
Representative Olson, no, I don't have any to move right now. I do plan to do that on Wednesday, and I will explain that.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
If I might, are you expecting that we'll take any votes before 2:15 on this issue?
Representative Holberg, I do not.
All right, thank you.
We announced before there will not be any votes. I mean, I thought there might have been an amendment. We would have put that into the bill right now because it was, I had understood it might be an author's amendment, but we won't do anything on it until Wednesday. Thank you. To the bill, Representative Johnson, I appreciate your patience.
Certainly.
Annexation is related to eminent domain.
It is, but I don't want to talk about that. This is a much less controversial issue. Mr. Chairman, did you want me to walk through the bill again as I did the other night, or would that not be helpful?
Members, we had really good attendance the other night. Is there anybody who feels that Representative Johnson needs to go through the bill again? Representative Johnson?
All right.
If then you want.
I will just then make a couple of general comments, and then I would like to explain the two or possibly three amendments that Representative Thiessen and I have been working on that I do expect to bring forward on Wednesday, but we haven't finalized the language yet. But as I mentioned, just briefly at least on last Wednesday night, we have been working on this bill for many months. In fact, my original bill was in June or July. That was the old one-sentence bill, and since then this has grown and contracted and grown again and contracted again. And I think that we have made significant changes to address some real and legitimate issues. And to probably be a little less restrictive with respect to eminent domain than what I had originally intended. And I am, again, willing to go a little bit further in that direction, and will do so on Wednesday. In fact, I think a lot further. I still expect that there will be some people who don't like the bill because they think that it still restricts eminent domain too much, but I would respectfully disagree with that rather strongly. And again, as I mentioned on Wednesday night, the two basic principles in this bill are that if government needs to take property through eminent domain for economic development purposes and transfer it from one private entity to another, I want that to be difficult, more difficult than it is now, because the current legal court-created standard that we have now is very, very much weighed towards government as opposed to the rights of private property owners. And that's an understatement to say very much. It's almost complete. And the other principle in the bill is that if government needs to take something for a traditional public use, such as a road or a school or a government building or something like that, we do not want to stand in the way of that, and this bill does not do so. However, it has a couple of provisions that will make it more certain that individual property owners do get just compensation, justly compensated, as is required under the Constitution in both Minnesota and the United States. Let me, if I may, just outline the two most significant amendments that we are currently working on and that I do intend to offer on Wednesday, or have somebody offer for me on Wednesday. The first has to do with the definition of environmental contamination. If you remember, what we said was that government can take for economic development and take from one private entity and transfer to another if the government, or the city most often, can show that the property is environmentally contaminated. And there has been a considerable amount of testimony as to how the definition of environmental contamination that we have in the bill currently is not very workable, and that there are going to be very few instances where you could actually rise to that level. And that is not my intent, and it never has been. And so what we intend to do is introduce an amendment, or have someone do that for me, that says that if you can show that more than 50% of the parcels in a development area are contaminated, not 50% of the, what the bill currently says is 50% of the surface area is contaminated within an area, but instead if you can show that 50%, more than 50% of the parcels in an area are contaminated, then government can take the entire area, as long as they can show that it's necessary, absolutely necessary, to take the non-contaminated areas in order to remediate the contamination. I think that is a very significant move towards what several city officials at least have suggested is unworkable in this bill. The other piece is a different definition of blight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want him to go through all of the proposed amendments, or if we had a question about one, do you want us to take it now or at the end? Or?
Representative Johnson, would you prefer to go through?
I only have two. So
why don't you go ahead and explain the other one, and then we'll take questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other is with respect to the definition of blight, and we have not hammered out the exact language, but right now essentially what the bill says is that in order to reach the blight standard, which again would allow for an exception so that government can take property and transfer it to another private entity, you have to show that the property, more than 50% of the property, is unfit for human use, which, as I mentioned last week, is a very high standard. I recognize that. I still think it's a reasonable standard, but many people do not. And so we are willing to change that definition of blight to show that, rather than show that a piece of property is unfit for human use, a government has to show that it's structurally substandard. And that means there has to be a significant code violation of something structural about the building, like the walls or the foundation or the roof. And we will have a laundry list of exactly what that includes. And you have to show that it is substantial. It's not a cracked window or something small, but you're going to have to show, the government's going to have to show that the estimated cost of fixing that structural problem is 50% of the tax assessed market value. Again, this is a very significant move towards what I think the League of Cities, at least, has testified is a problematic part of the bill.
Questions? Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. I want to say thank you for recognizing or for addressing some of the concerns with your amendments. The one about the blighted area and for that the cost would be 50% of the assessed value, is that the assessed value of the structure or the structure and the land that it sits on?
Representative Hosh, just the structure.
Representative Johnson. Representative Hosh.
Thank you. That's all I needed. That addresses my concern.
Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, you were talking about the amendment that is changing the ground contamination.
Yes.
And the comment that you made that it was absolutely necessary to take it in order to remediate the contamination. Is that the case, or is it to in order to complete the project? Because I see someone shaking their head behind you.
The language as it is right now requires absolute necessity.
I'm talking about the amendment. Sorry.
Right now it says to complete the remediation. The last version of the amendment that I saw had the same language. Now, are we talking about doing something different?
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Lee McGrath, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice, Minnesota Chapter. Mr. Chair, Representative Pilstrom, what the amendment will do is will allow cities to take every environmentally contaminated property that it wants to. Additionally, a city may take non-environmentally contaminated properties if it can show that it is necessary to take those in order to remediate the environmentally contaminated areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The only reason why I'm asking that is because we had parcels in my district for which we got a grant to help clean up. It was a Superfund site. And while we needed to take certain parcels to do the cleanup, in order to make the entire project feasible, there was another part of the property that we needed to take in order to actually build something to pay the bills for the cleanup. So is that what you're meaning, that in order to do the cleanup, you could take a parcel to afford the cleanup? Or I'm just not certain as to what your intent is here.
Representative Hillstrom, and again, we're still working on the language, so I'm happy to talk with you about this more. My thought would be the language as we have it drafted right now specifically says you have to show that you have to have the property to remediate the contamination as opposed to complete the project. Again, we can talk about that more if that's going to be problematic.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said on the other amendment had to do with structural problems, and my professional hat popped up. Structure seems to be superstructure and roof, and there could be lots of issues with cosmetics, fire life safety. Will those also be included? And I don't want to discuss the amendment before you get here with it, but...
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, I don't have a list in front of me, but Mr. McGrath may know offhand. Yes,
laundry list.
At least the draft has one right now. So, thank you. I do have the list in front of me. Let me just read off to, this is what we're looking at right now. Here's the definition. Structurally substandard. For the purposes of this session, structurally substandard means building code violations related exclusively to the building's roof and roof framing elements, support walls, beams, and headers, foundation footings and subgrade conditions, light and ventilation, fire protection including egress, internal utilities including electricity, gas, and water, flooring and flooring elements, and walls, insulation, and exterior envelope.
Okay. Just, Mr. Chairman, as a point, when we were at the first hearing and we were in Brooklyn Center, that one of the issues there was, again, buildings can be a real nuisance to a community if they're really ugly, bad shape, and is that going to be, could that be part of it? I mean, irresponsible landlords who maintain a property that is disgusting to the community, is, could that be an issue?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, what we're trying to do is create a definition. So this is objective rather than subjective. And ugly, bad shape is rather subjective, obviously, especially if you happen to be the person who maybe lives in that building. And so here's what we're trying to do. So if somebody says the building is ugly or I don't like it or I think it's disgusting, that will not be enough. There's going to have to be a showing that it's structurally substandard, or there's also, of course, the piece in the bill that says that if it is a public nuisance, which is actually a rather broad definition, that it would also fall under that category.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a number of questions I'd like to ask Representative Johnson, but I'll just start with a couple here for right now. Representative Johnson, I appreciate the fact that you've included in this bill, in effect, an exemption if you're talking about infrastructure. I'm looking at the subdivision 11 on page 3. The question that comes to my mind is, what about a circumstance where the business itself or redevelopment itself, there is no eminent domain, but in order to get services or access to that development or redevelopment, you have to use eminent domain. It seems to me that the way this language is currently drafted, people could in effect say that since that you're using eminent domain to get access or provide services, that you're in effect violating the other provision of this section. Is that the intent here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, can you give me an example of what sort of a, are you looking at like an ingress road or something like that, essentially?
Well, let's say you have a development or a redevelopment that doesn't involve that eminent domain. This bill would prohibit the use of eminent domain for that development or redevelopment unless other criteria are met. But what about providing access or services to that? Does the fact that you're providing access or services bring into play Subdivision 11, Part 4?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, if you're talking about a road, for example, that to me, my intent would be that clearly would fall under the definition of public use. So if you're talking about road access to a private development.
Yes, where you had to use eminent domain.
Right. That would
put in an access road to a private development.
That's right. If it's, and is the access road a public road?
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Then it would definitely fall under the bill as I intended.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I don't think the language here is real clear.
Right.
I appreciate your intent, but I don't think the language is clear. And I think it would subject this to a court challenge, that someone could claim that you can't use eminent domain to put in a road because it's servicing only there for the benefit of a business or a redevelopment or a development. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lanning, I do. My reading would be a little different actually under A1, but we certainly can look at making that crystal clear.
Thank you. My second question I wanted to ask you about, Representative Johnson, the focus of this bill is on property that might be subject to eminent domain and protecting the rights of those property owners, and I think all of us agree that we need to build more safeguards into protecting those property rights. I guess my question is, the bill doesn't address in any way the property rights of other affected property. You may have the rights of property where you have willing sellers that they would like to be able to move to a new facility. They're in support of this project. You may have property rights of adjoining property that feel that the property is blighted in their view. What about the property rights of other affected property here? Willing sellers, those who are adjacent. The bill does nothing or says nothing about those rights. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning. And I think you bring up an important point and a fair point. And there are kind of a couple different examples that you suggested. One is if you have property nearby someone else's that is blighted or it's in really bad, it's in significant disrepair or maybe it's being used for something that people don't think is very savory in the community. And I do believe that that is addressed in that we allow for, again, truly blighted property or contaminated property or something that's a public nuisance to be taken through eminent domain, even for economic development, and even some of the surrounding property to be taken in that manner if it's not blighted or not contaminated, but it is a high standard. With respect to property that doesn't rise to this specific level, in other words, I've got a neighbor who's not, you know, whose house looks crappy because he doesn't keep it up or she doesn't keep it up and they don't mow their grass. We still have the traditional police powers of the state and the city or the county or whoever to come in and require people to keep their property up. I mean, that's being used every day now through fines or other processes. We're talking now about not just requiring somebody to keep their house up and to keep their yard looking halfway decent and not parking RVs in their driveway. For some of us in the suburbs, that's always a big issue. But rather, whether we can actually take their home away from them if they won't do it because their neighbors don't like what it looks like or are uncomfortable with it. So I think that there are certainly provisions currently that do provide for the protection of property owners who maybe don't like how someone else is using their own property.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to wrap this up, Representative Johnson, I'm going to work on an amendment to provide some additional language that I think gives more protection to other property who may be affected here. So we can talk about that more when we take amendments on Wednesday. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, the code violation point, before we get that too far behind us, have you discussed that with like Tom Joachim and the building codes? Or anybody there?
I'd say that again. I didn't.
Have you discussed your code violation language with somebody in the department or building codes division? Now it's in the Department of Labor and Industry.
Mr. Chairman, I have not. Have we? No, we have not, but we certainly can do that.
I think it would be wise to do that.
Okay.
My concern is this, that some of these older homes inherently have code violations, and they may be considered under your language to be unsafe, even though they've been that way since they were built and lived in since for 30, 40, 50 years. And to today's standards, they were unsafe when they were built and they've been lived in that long. It doesn't make sense that that would be a condition for destruction.
I would agree. We'll check into that.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I have two questions for you, and I'm contemplating and also some amendments for Wednesday. When I asked you at, I think it was our first meeting, about the problem that we had in St. Paul on University Avenue where there were several porn shops, you said under your bill and under current statute, that the city of St. Paul would have been able to take those properties with eminent domain. If I asked you whether they could do that under your bill, and you said yes. And subsequently, we asked the city attorney's office whether under your bill we could do that, and they said no. So, A, who's right, and B, would you be amenable to some language that may have a broader explanation of public nuisance that would incorporate porn shops and those kinds of activities that we're trying to get out of our neighborhoods.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, you know, I don't remember exactly what I said. I think I may have said that yes, as long as you can define it as a public nuisance under the statute. So if, I am open to talking about that. I'm probably not all that interested in protecting the rights of porn shop owners as much as I am in homeowners and legitimate business owners. So if you have a suggestion with respect to that, I'm open to it.
Okay. The second question, Mr. Chair, is I'm not sure why this came to the Public Safety Committee, which I'm also a member of, and Representative Newman offered an amendment that sort of flew in there. And that is section 6 of your bill on page 4, on non-conforming use. So before this gets addressed on Wednesday, I was wondering if you could inform us a little bit about where this language came from, why it's here. Isn't this already required under current state law, and what is the intent of Section 6?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pimar, it was Representative Newman's amendment, but some folks did talk to me about it before that, and the folks that first brought this up were the, for lack of a better term, the billboard people. And what they have found in at least some instances is that they will be on a piece of property, the zoning is changed, so all of a sudden they are now a legal non-conforming use, and then when the property owner decides that they want a permit for something totally unrelated, the city's response is, we'll only do that if you remove the billboard. Now, it might also extend to other things, but that was the genesis of it, and frankly, it seemed to me to be a good amendment, and I also told the folks that came to me that if there is a fight about it, they would need to come to the table and talk about it more so than me.
Mr. Chair, I just, obviously concerned. I mean, this is something, as you know, the city of St. Paul has been trying to work with the billboard industry, and we just, the legislature took away the ability to amateurize billboards, and now the billboard industry is coming in with this bill that I thought was relatively clean on eminent domain, as is dirtying it all up with its own business here, that really takes another planning and development tool away from the city. And so, I mean, I don't know how that this committee feels about it, but I just think to add that kind of language at this stage without any real thorough opportunity, I don't know if my city even knows that this is in here. And I think this, while it might affect other cities, it really affects the city of St. Paul. And I just, this is what bothers me about not just the billboard industry, but I consider sneaking in language that really has a dramatic impact on cities without giving the cities an opportunity to sit down at the table here and let you know, let us know what their concerns are.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Shalanda may have something else to add, but President Paymar, if I wanted to sneak something in, I would have waited until the very end instead of, 3 out of 7 committee hearings. So I suspected this would come up and talk about it more. But Ms. Shalanda might have some thoughts.
Who's this?
Ms. Shalanda, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Shalanda. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, part of the coalition that's supporting this bill. And I just wanted to point out one other thing about this section. I appreciate your concern about the billboard issue itself, but there are other industries in the coalition that also are concerned about having a legal non-conforming use removed without just compensation. As I understand this provision, that it doesn't say that the city can't require the legal nonconforming use to be removed. It just says that they have to pay just compensation for that taking.
Mr. Chairman, since it's Representative Johnson's intent not to sneak anything in, will there be ample time then for the city and Scenic Minnesota and Scenic St. Paul and all of the environmental groups that have concerns about billboards. They have an opportunity to address this committee on Wednesday.
Representative Pimar, I can't commit that kind of time. We don't have that kind of time. And as we all know, amendments can come up that would affect people that don't always get to testify, and that's information that comes out often on the House floor, and that's pretty normal in the process. The intention was, our time has been cut short with the previous bill, the intention was to have the remainder of today's committee time for testimony and discussion on the bill, and on Wednesday was going to allow a minute or so of testimony on amendments, but if even that has to be restrained somewhat, because if we had 10 people wanting to testify, we'd run out of time, wouldn't get the bill done.
Mr. Chair, but you see the awkward position that Representative Johnson has at least put me in, and put this language in without anyone getting notified about the impact on it. And so I would, if the city, I will inform my city about what's happened, and if you would, I would just ask that they at least be given an opportunity to testify about the impact of that language.
Representative Pimar, with all due respect, you'd get a lot further with that plea if you weren't always hanging these concerns on the author of the bill who didn't introduce the amendment, and I don't believe there's any evidence that he did in fact slip this in. It is our duty as members of this committee that if we see concerns in an amendment, that we may need to go check it out and try to get people here to testify, and we will, if time permits, allow people to testify. But this is an amendment that came into the bill, and I didn't get a request from anybody. As you noted, you knew about it from sitting on Judiciary. I didn't get a request. I don't believe Mary Cummins got a request from anybody to testify on this bill today, and it was announced. So I'm sorry if nobody was notified about it between the Public Finance Committee and this one, because that's the reason the notice was out there, and they would have had ample opportunity to let Mary Cummins know and myself that they need to testify today.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I just, just so you know, when this was offered by Representative Newman, it was not really explained, and so it sort of happened. And all I'm asking is I don't want to invite someone to come down here and testify if they can't testify on Wednesday.
They have them call my office. Come call my office.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pimar. Members, out of concern to two people who are on the list to testify, I'm going to, we have four on the list yet, and we can go a little over. If there's anybody on the list that can't stay a little later, I'm going to ask that Alyssa Schlander, who was on the list, and Leland Frankman will be next. We'll make sure we have those who put their names on the list able to testify today, give them the opportunity that they deserve because they went through the effort of getting themselves on the list, and then we'll continue with our discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I said before, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I apologize for coming in late. The Senate is also taking testimony on this bill right now, so I hope I'm not being redundant with anything that was said previously. But I just thought I'd just give the committee a quick overview of why the auto dealers are involved and all of the other groups are supporting Representative Johnson's bill, House File 2846. It all started for us when the city of Richfield used eminent domain to condemn three of our auto dealerships so that Best Buy could build its corporate headquarters at the corner of 494 and Penn in the city of Richfield. And ever since then, the Auto Dealers Association has been working toward reforming Minnesota's eminent domain laws, and we've been here since 2003 asking for a reform bill from the state legislature. So although the court case that got a lot of attention this summer sort of catapulted this issue into the spotlight, the Kuehl versus New London, Connecticut case. I just wanted to remind you and let you know that this isn't really, for us, it's not that we woke up in June and said, hey, that seems like a good thing to take on. We really have been trying to work on reform for the last several years, and it was just the Kuehl case over the summer that really just sparked the outrage over the state of the current law in Minnesota.
So I just wanted to let you know that we've been working to build partnerships with members of all parties of the state legislature and working with a diverse coalition of interested citizens and interest groups. We've got about 22 various interest groups from all corners of the political spectrum and, you know, metro, rural, you name it. I wish I had that. I do have that. List the auto dealers, the farm groups, the NAACP of both Minneapolis and St. Paul, the Urban League, the Hmong Chamber of Commerce, Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the Petroleum Marketers Association, the Federation of Independent Businesses, the St. Paul Black Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance, the Minnesota Teamsters, the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers, the Outdoor Advertising Association, as we discussed earlier, Hospitality Minnesota, the Trucking Association, the Family Council, Manufactured Housing, the Cattlemen's Association, Wheat Growers, and the Highway Construction Industry Council. So I just wanted to let you know that those are the groups that are involved in supporting this effort. But in addition to the interest groups, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of individuals who have contacted us via website to say that they support reforming Minnesota's eminent domain laws. And clearly, there are people either who have unique land uses, who are afraid of Walzer-style takings like that we saw in Richfield, farm groups who are interested in preserving their agricultural land, which is often viewed as vacant land, and small businesses who are targeted for redevelopment, for projects that often make way for big box retailers and high-end development, and basically individuals who are oftentimes economically and politically disadvantaged and who have really an unfair, unlevel playing field under the current state of Minnesota's eminent domain laws, that we just are really asking for some fairness to be put back into the law here to protect the individual. So I will close. I just wanted to let you know who's been working on this. We thank Representative Johnson for his leadership on this issue. He's done a great job explaining exactly what's in the bill, and I can just hang around if there are questions that may need to be answered. But thank you for spending so much time on this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Schlander? Thank you. Leland Franklin, welcome to the committee and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Leland Franklin. I represent nobody in particular other than the citizens that I represent in condemnation cases. I've been doing the cases for 40 years. And I worked for an attorney general. I worked for the Democratic Attorney General, Mr. Mattson. I worked for Doug Head. I condemn property for the highway system, and I've done a lot of the big cases in the state. Now, the man that I've been listening to that hit the nail on the head the most was this gentleman here, Mr. Lanning, the Representative Lanning, asking what's going to happen to the other people that are affected by this bill. Now, I think before you pass this law, you should talk to some lawyers who represent landowners to find out what the consequences are of what you're really doing here. Now, I represented Opus Corporation on the Nicollet Mall when they put the Target Center there. And I didn't think that was a correct taking, because Jerry Roundhorse, who owned the Opus Company, had a press release which said he had from Grundhoff $110 million to put up his own skyscraper. Didn't need tax increment financing. Didn't need the government involved to take the property. He could have put it up himself. But Dayton Hudson, Target, they wanted Ryan Construction Company, and so did the mayor, Belton. So they took the property, and the Court of Appeals in our case said, well, we defer to the legislative branch. Now, I don't think that's right. And I think probably you ought to tighten up the standard. But I think it's an absolute mistake to blanket takings for all economic development. And the reason why is Mr. Lanning hit the nail on the head. My clients, and I represent auto dealers right now in a condemnation case,
I represent citizens who are losing their front yards to Hennepin County on Highway 101. I represent an ex-legislator that's got a road, that just had a road go through his forest up in Little Falls. And I'm just telling you, what people want is certainty in their lives more than they care about losing their property. And what this bill is going to do, that first of all, once the toothpaste is out of a tube, you're never going to put it back. You're never going to stop private developers now and cities cooperating to get rid of blight, to get rid of situations where the cities need to improve their cities. Richfield was an example of that. So what's going to happen is the private developers are going to go out like they do now, and they're going to pick up most of the properties by direct purchase. But what's going to happen is instead of one or two people that are holding up the progress in that city, who they would condemn, now what's going to happen is you're going to have a bunch of court cases under this new legislation, or you're going to have what just happened in Missouri. And I saw it on Hannity and Combs. What you're going to have is, instead of people coming and buying the properties, taking them out, okay, and saying, all right, there's a couple of people that are holding the progress, going to take the property. What's going to happen is, people are going to come in now, like in Missouri, and put down, developers are going to put down the buy them on contract for deeds, put down little deposits, and say, until we get those other parcels, we're in limbo. And that's going to stop the rest of my clients who are involved in around the area who are going to be taken normally. It's going to stop them from knowing where they are for years. They're not going to know whether their property is going to be taken. They aren't going to be able to get a mortgage. They aren't going to be able to list it because realtors tell them you've got to disclose. And so what's going to happen is it's going to be a mess. So I don't think it's a good idea. Now, if you're going to restrict development for economic development, if that's what you want to do, why don't you go to Chapter 469, which is the economic development statute, and just say, we're not going to take any more property for development. If you're going to toy with Chapter 117, which I think is one of the best condemnation statutes in the United States, and I know about a lot of other statutes in the United States because I go to these national seminars, then there's some changes you ought to make. Now, for instance, very quickly, when you talk about minimum compensation under Section 8, minimum compensation, that refers to 117.042, that's the quick take law. That quick take law was passed in 1971, and I know a little bit about it because I wrote it. I was on the committee that wrote that statute. And now the government, the last six cases I've tried against MnDOT, they have come in and testified to less money than they gave my owners on the quick take. I just had a case, it's a little case. We won a couple of $100,000. MnDOT did a quick take, $45,000. They brought an appraiser at $12,000. They wanted to give some money back. Now, when they take your property by quick take, the owner can't give his property back. And so the government shouldn't be able to come in and testify for less. So why does it just say if you're taking, when an owner must relocate, at a minimum must be sufficient for an owner to purchase a similar house or building equivalent. Why don't you just say in Section 117.042, and I've written letters to the various legislators that I've dealt with over the years on this subject, why don't you write into 117.042 that when that money is given, it can't be given back, and the government should not be allowed to testify or ask a commission or a jury to award less than the quick take. That's one issue. Now, I also want to say that I met with Representative Johnson in the governor's office with ex-Senator Gaither, and I told him what I felt about this bill, so he's not surprised by what I'm saying now. I've met with Lee McGrath many times and discussed this. Okay? But I'm just saying, but I'm not sure you all know what you're doing here. I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example on contamination. Just tried a case for a fellow who has a towing service in St. Paul. It's under the Phelan Corridor. And that property is contaminated. But it would be, the government and the landowner both testified that the highest and best use of the property is for a towing service. Nobody's ever going to disturb the soil. The city of St. Paul offered them $1 million for the property. And we had the temerity to fight them on it, want more money for the property. They came in and testified to $600,000 at the hearing and said, now we gave you a quick take of $1 million, we want $400,000 back because it's contaminated. In other words, they were punishing us. And I said, but the property wouldn't be disturbed for the next 50 years, unless it were for the Phelan Corridor, and that's after the taking. It's a towing service. You just park cars on it, okay? Now, under this bill, the way I read it, one of the reasons now for taking is that it's contaminated. So the government is going to go out and do a lot of testing if they want to take the property to determine it's contaminated. There's going to be a lot more thorough, whether it's a torn property or a property that would never be disturbed. The question is, who's going to pay for it? Because under 117.05, the commissioner's statute, it says the commissioners must take off the reward what it costs to remediate the property. So there's going to be more contamination findings now by the government to get into the public purpose definition, and now the government's going to try to stick the landowner with the cost of remediation, whether or not as a practical matter it would ever have to be remediated or not. So the question we've got to ask is, what are you doing here? Now, I talked to the governor. I talked to him in Florida. Apparently, to talk to the governor, now you have to go to Florida, which is all right. I like to spend time down there. And he said to me, well, forget it, Lee. It's going to happen. Okay? The liberals want it. The conservatives want it. It's going to happen. Okay? But I just say that the consequences are not going to be what you think they are. First of all, I think the taking for Opus, and I'm not here representing Opus. It's the only case I've ever done for them. On the Nicollet Mall, I think Opus should have put up the skyscraper. The city shouldn't have taken it away from them. I think the Kelo case in Connecticut was right. Lee McGrath is with the Institute of Justice. They fought that. It was right. It was right because the city was in a depression. The shipbuilding industry had gone to hell. They had unemployment. They needed to do something. And they did it. Now you're going to stop that wholesale here, is what you're going to do. The cities want to develop their property. And I think it's a mistake, even though I represent landowners. Because most of my landowners, like Mr. Lanning says, are going to be on the periphery. And their properties are going to go to blazes while they're waiting to determine now whether the city can do it or not. Or whether the city can buy up that last parcel from this holdout who's been offered 3 or 4 times what his properties were, but he doesn't want to sell. Just because we want to protect private property. Now, I'll close with this. There's all sorts of things that go on in this state where private property is affected and people lose money and we don't do anything about it. A good example is zoning. A lot of my clients have a property, they're ready to put up some commercial development, and the city's comprehensive plan all of a sudden says, no, it's going to be residential. What do they get paid for that? Nothing. And the people that are going for this bill, okay, are talking about the Constitution and just compensation. And the Constitution was only adapted for roads and for schools. Well, I'll tell you something. I read a book about John Adams written by McCulloch. At the time the Constitution was passed, Boston was 8,000 people. And John Adams went to the convention in Philadelphia, they had 20,000 people. So all they cared about was roads. But now we care about land use planning. And how can cities have land use planning if they can't get together with private development and develop the cities the way it should be developed? So it's all sorts of now in a modern society effects what happened to people. And a lot of my clients suffer when they take their property, but they suffer more when there's a delay. They suffer more when they're in limbo, when they're waiting years for something to happen. And that's what this bill will do.
Mr. Leland, your comments are very interesting. Your initial comments are very good, and I do not understand that. And you provided an example for those comments, unless you meant the case in Richfield.
Is that correct? You want an example?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I've got an example in, I've got another case in Richfield now. I represent Assad, a fellow who sells Assad. All right? I'll give you a better example. This is a highway taking. I had a woman I represented was a beautician, and she was divorced. And her only asset was her house. She had a mortgage on the house, and she couldn't afford to pay the mortgage, and the house went into default. And she was in her equity of redemption. You know what that is. She has a right to redeem, and she had like maybe a month. So she got a realtor, and the realtor went out and got a buyer, and they signed a purchase agreement. She could have sold the house, and she had some cash value. But the highway department, my friends at Nimbot, my alma mater, they had a meeting in the neighborhood, the meeting was, well, we might run a highway through this area, and we might do it in 5 years, we might do it in 10 years, we might do it, we might not. Well, the realtor found out about that and said to this woman, I've got to disclose to the buyer that the property may be acquired. They asked me my legal advice. I said, you know, you really don't. Because MnDOT may put highways there and may not. Lightning will strike, but it may not. Well, they disclosed to the buyer, and the buyer went away. The equity redemption ran out. She lost the money. She got nothing for it because of the delay. I've got a guy who sells sod in Richfield. Right now, Richfield is developing, maybe we're from Richfield, I don't know, Mr. Olson, but Richfield is developing there. It's an economic development. And guess what? They aren't doing a quick take. They aren't doing a quick take because the developer's having some difficulties. I don't know what they are. So my client went out, we were told we're going to take his property, went out and bought another property. Now, we had a commissioner's view. You know, the commissioners come out to view the property. We're going to have hearings. And you know what they say to him? Well, no, we're not so sure when we're going to take the property. Maybe next fall. He said, well, I just bought a property. You know? So he's going to be selling stock out of two places. He wishes they had done a quick take. He wishes they'd given him some money. He wished he could move off. Now he's in limbo. Okay? I've got all sorts of examples of that. I'm just saying that the quicker the stiletto goes in and comes out, the better it is. And developers are not going to stop acquiring properties in the cities now.
Mr. Leland, the last analogy is probably the best. If you think of your historical example in terms of where we began, I tend to think of the economic development that occurred across this country and in this state for centuries without any involvement from government. It occurred on its own. I don't know how far back zoning laws go, but at one point it occurred without any zoning laws. And granted, we can't operate like that anymore, because we do have too much population. But I still don't see where these examples apply directly to this bill.
You don't?
No.
Well,
I mean, if you could point to something specific in the bill that's going to cause the process to be slowed down for certain, then I would see how those examples fit. Like the lady who was delayed more than a month, what in the bill would have, that happened without the bill. What in the bill means that that situation would be worse.
I'll tell you why there's no specific examples as per your question. And that is because we've had eminent domain. You're asking me to give you examples of when we have this bill and the bill interferes to some great degree with people's lives. Well, after the bill is passed, I'll give you the example. The Missouri example is the best example. And I recorded that thing on a tape with this Hannity and Combs thing. They demagogue this thing every night when I watch them on Fox News, but this was an interesting one. This is one where there's a large residential area with very low-priced homes, one-car garages, that type of thing. And the city of Missouri decided to partner with a developer. They're going to put up a big shopping center. They went out and they bought lots of houses. The developer went out directly and bought lots of houses, but he bought them under contract for deed. Okay, and he put some money down. And when he put some money down, the people said, can we move out? Yes, we can move out. So they moved out. And an existing shopping center group brought an action against the city and said this was not for public purpose. And they tied it, and now it's in the courts. And it will be in the courts for a number of years. Well, the people who had bought these other houses had made promises about when they were going to close and so forth. They couldn't do that because the developer says, well, now that we're in litigation on the public purpose issue, I can't close and I can't give the rest of the money for the properties. And so meanwhile, vandals have come in and struck their houses and the people are all in limbo. And it's all because there's a great deal of uncertainty. And the lawyers who represent the owners in these cases will tell you that you can't have that. And that's the best example of what will happen in this situation. So I just ask you, I'm just saying it won't happen in all cases. I think you could write in a standard. You could say, look, the court has to really look carefully. A fair preponderance of the evidence, whatever burden you want to put on, because it is a taking. But to say that all takings for economic development are not for the public purpose is wrong. Now, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who, when I watched the Alito hearings on TV, is being proposed for statehood, she said, what's to stop taking the Motel 6 and turning it into a Ritz-Carlton? But I think she's wrong. Because there is a test. It was enunciated by the court in Philo, and it's the test in Minnesota. And the test is that the private developer may benefit, but the public has to benefit more. And you can write in a burden that does that, and the court has to scrutinize it carefully if you want to do that. But to limit categories of what's best for economic development for the public is a big mistake. That's my point.
I appreciate your comments, Mr. Leland. I'll just...
My name's Frankman, by the way.
I'm sorry. Mr. Leland Frankman. Begging your pardon, sir. Mr. Frankman, as far as the dagger going in and out, what I'm concerned about, and I know other members here as well, is that the dagger shouldn't go in and out. And if a bill prevents that dagger effect, economic development would occur without the fallout you're describing by way of the fact that the developers would go to the property owners, and if they don't have an agreement to sell, the decision would be made and it wouldn't be prolonged at all. Knowing there's a dagger option, that prolongs the decision. And that's when it gets tied up in court.
You know what's really going to happen? What I think is going to happen is going to be a lot of special legislation coming in here. Because Bloomington or Duluth is going to say, you know, on Excelsior Boulevard in St. Louis Park, they've got a beautiful development. I had owners that I represented there in that case. A beautiful development. I live in Golden Valley. We had a development that was on 55 and Winnetka. Beautiful. And we want to do it. And the city is going to say, we can't do it because we've got a bill. So Bloomington, whoever it is, they're going to go to the legislator and say, we want an exemption from this law because we've got a developer that's willing to put up $100 million and we've got a bad area and we want to fix it up. That's what the citizens in the area want, other than two or three people that won't have to sell. And so they'll come over to the legislature, and the Bloomington legislator will say to the legislator in Duluth, I want you to help me with this. I want a special bill exempting it. And then a year later, the Duluth legislator is going to say to the Bloomington legislator, I want you to help me with the same thing. That's what you're going to see. That's going to take time, because it's going to have to go through the legislature. And it's going to be more expensive and time-consuming, and the landowners, my clients, will be in limbo. But that's what I think is going to happen. They aren't going to stop. The cities aren't going to stop. Because it works, because they have to do it.
Questions? More questions for Mr. Frankman? Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. Back to the list, Representative Lancheski.
Chair, I can wait till tonight. I have questions for Representative Johnson.
That's where we are. If it's all right with members, I was going to go till 1:45.
Oh, that's fine. Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, and I thought that was an interesting last comment. I turned to Representative Wardlow and I said the first special legislation will be to exempt the stadium. And I did do some checking because the Vikings would certainly not be able to build under this legislation. Looks like the Twins might be able to because so much land has already been purchased. So I think that last point was very interesting because I agree that there will be all kinds of special exceptions. If this bill were to pass. But I do have a question for Representative Johnson. You mentioned in your testimony that you might have a couple of amendments, and I don't know if I didn't hear you right, but you mentioned, I thought you said something like 50% of taxable market value. Is that what you said? Can you explain that?
That's correct. That was the piece that defines blight or dilapidated building.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I thought you had mentioned you were going to have an amendment maybe on blight, but then you did on page 2, subdivision 6 is blight, but you started talking about the dilapidated building definition, subdivision 7, so that's where I kind of got confused.
Sure.
Are you going to amend dilapidated buildings or amend blight, which are different things? And
I'm sorry.
Where was the taxable market value component coming in?
Let me explain that a little better, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson. One of the exceptions, Mr. Frankman commented that economic development is not going to be allowed under or eminent domain for economic development is not going to be allowed under this bill, that's not really accurate because if you can show blight or environmental contamination or these other areas, it will be. And blight is one of those exceptions, and the definition of blight is states that it's zoned for urban use and more than 50% of the buildings are dilapidated. And so what we've done, this really changes the definition of blight by changing the definition of dilapidated buildings. And what the new definition, instead of unfit for human use, it's going to say they have to be structurally substandard. We list what that means. And then also you have to show that, and I've got the language here, a building is not structurally substandard if the estimated cost of satisfying the cited structural building code violations do not exceed 50% of the assessor's estimated market value for the building for property taxes payable in the year in which the condemnation commenced. So it's all part of that definition of dilapidated, which is part of the definition of blight. Does that help?
It does help. And Mr. Chair, and we can talk about it privately maybe on the floor because we do have session, but also because I'm bringing it up now because this bill, I guess, is not going to tax us, which I think is unfortunate. But hearing you say that, our assessors have to assess all taxable property to its highest best use, which the standard is so very high for that. I mean, you could, in theory, have a farm assessed at the potential of a major commercial industrial office space, and you could not meet that test, if I'm understanding what you just said. So maybe we should have a conversation about that, because I'd like to think about that one a little bit. The other thing is, in the blight definition, how are you defining urban use? Is are you meaning to exempt this blight definition for Greater Minnesota? I'm not understanding what urban use is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, somebody might have to help me with this, but my understanding is that is currently in statute. That is something that we already have in statute.
Ms. Schlander.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Lincheski, we took that piece of the urban use piece, modeling that after the language in the TIF statute, and it is my understanding that we're not exempting rural Minnesota, but trying to exempt rural areas. So if there are rural cities that have urban areas, that's what we mean by that. That there are certainly cities in rural Minnesota that this would apply to. We're just trying to say that you know, vacant land is not blighted.
And I just want to put on the record here, tell you, and again, we can talk about this at the Apple Valley hearing. We talked about it as a committee. And we heard a lot of testimony on it, and I will have an amendment. I haven't seen it yet. I'd show it to you on tax increment financing. I'm sure you're aware that there are, I think, 2,000 TIF districts in the state of Minnesota, many of them who have eminent domain, and I would assume that you would be comfortable with exempting everything that's underway or in the pipeline. Why it matters in eminent domain is many of them have eminent domain as part of their TIF districts, and in fact, when their councils passed their TIF plans and certified districts, their performance, their financials are dependent on these eminent domain takings happening. Sometimes in a 25-year TIF district, the actual taking of the property, the eminent domain activity, might not happen until year 22. That is in the plan. That business owner has been told in 2019, we're going to buy your property, you may conduct business until then or whatever. And so I think we have situations across the state that would, if not put city councils into very serious financial difficulty, in some cases the cities may fall into default or go bankrupt, and then they'd be here at the state asking us to bail them out. So in general, when we do changes in tax areas in the tax committee, we take everything that's in place and we grandfather it in because of the complication where cities would lose their bond ratings. I mean, I can look at Representative Peterson and I mean, we certainly would be in shock in some takings that may be taking place 20 years out right now, that the bonds have already been let and things are underway. So I'll have an amendment like that. I wanted you to know that. I haven't even seen it, so maybe we can talk about that too.
Sure. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
I appreciate that, Representative Lincheski. I have to learn that issue a little bit better. But the amazing part to me was that nobody had ever brought that up before in all the lobbying over the months. That was new to me, and it seems like it's something we ought to be able to fix. And on the stadium, I don't want to talk about stadiums, but I have talked to the Vikings, and they intend apparently to own their stadium, which the stadium at least then would fall under the traditional definition of public use. Now, if the city wants to come and take surrounding property for development, that's going to be more difficult, obviously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add on that I think the problem will be these things. If you can call a stadium public use, you can call anything public use. And so, you know, I mean, that's where I think the problem is in this, when it's economic development versus roads. And the testifier said he had read the book on John Adams. I've read that book as well. And interestingly, in that book, economic development in that time was roads. So it's how you define it. I mean, you can argue that roads are economic development, and now in the bill they're not, and something else is. And so I think it's just interesting to think about what we would consider a public purpose in 20 years or 50 years or 100 years.
I have three more. Representative Marquardt, Representative Hillstrom, and Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, I do appreciate you bringing this forward. You know, to do nothing on this area is not an option. You know, when we listened to dozens of testifiers in Brooklyn Center and Apple Valley who were very emotional, some in tears, very choked up, we've got a process that has some problems. Mm-hmm. Something's gone awry. And so the big question is, how do you come up with something to deal with these abuses while still allowing cities to deal with blighted and dilapidated areas? And so one part, I guess the one comment is I'm happy to see you loosen up a little bit on the blighted definition and the substandard and so forth, because I think the way it currently is, it's way too restrictive, and cities wouldn't have those tools. My one question is, what I heard a lot in the testimony seemed to be coming down to communications. And I know when I served on the governor's task force, livestock sighting task force, one of the things that was a real problem is that the feedlot operators and the townships and the residents around there never really knew what the process was. And this caused all sorts of turmoil. And I'm wondering, especially as you kind of have addressed this under Section 11, Subdivision 2, the public hearing, that very last page, page 6, and there you do set up, Representative Johnson, a system where the owners would have a notification and so forth. But and I'm kind of thinking out loud, but would it be worthwhile to have some sort of a template established where the city and the property owners would know, you know, what is the process, what are your rights, that when the process is triggered, whether or not it's development, where they're going to look at developing an area, something would go out to all the prospective property owners who might be involved in the project to say, here's whatever, doesn't mean, but this, these are your rights, this is the option in which it would, here's 30-day requirements. I mean, I just think with a lot of these things, and I do, quite frankly, I think the cities in some cases have used a very heavy-handed, arm-twisting approach on some of this, which I don't think is right. And I think you try to address some of this, which needs to be addressed. But I do think if everyone was on the same page, just kind of like what they did with the livestock task force, I think it would eliminate a lot of the problems that we have that come down to communication. I guess your thoughts on something like that.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Marquardt, I appreciate that, but I had not thought about that or talked about it with anybody. It's possible others have, but we'll certainly take a look at that. Maybe we can talk some more if you have specific ideas, because I think information is helpful. And some of the mayors that I've talked to who don't like pieces of this bill have said that, you know, part of the problem is just process, and we would solve some of the problems just by making a more open process with more information. So that would be a good step.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I believe I mentioned this to you previously. Code enforcement is one of the things that my city implemented and did pretty aggressively in the 90s. But one of the challenges, and I've asked staff to get me some information, is there were times when the city would prosecute code violations and the judge would order a fine but not the cleanup of the code problem. And so that is an issue if that is going to be the case, that then after a while the city kind of stops prosecuting them. If you don't get them cleaned up, you just simply write citations, but then you don't fix the problem. The other thing is in terms of process, and we were told in the Public Safety Committee that this would cost the Department of Transportation about $14 million. And so can you explain to me when you're going to talk about the fiscal side of this and what committee is going to see that part and all of those things?
Mr. Chairman,
John Hellstrom,
Transportation Finance is going to see the bill. Ag first, then Transportation Finance, then probably some other folks who just want to see it. And we've asked, I met actually for quite a while with folks at the Department of Transportation last week to try to determine where they came up with that number. And after doing a lot of quizzing, they're looking at it again. So I'm not sure what the final number is going to be, but there will be a cost. If the bill doesn't change, there will certainly be a cost to the Department of Transportation, because more people will challenge takings who maybe don't feel like they could right now. And so, you know, my thought in talking to them is that their $14 million number is extremely high, as sometimes happens with these things. But we'll be addressing that in Transportation Finance.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about then the local government's portion of that, the county portion and the city's portion? Because if the state is saying that their share is that amount, high or low, what about the other local units of government's cost for roads? Those kinds of things.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Chairman, I have not heard estimates from anyone at the local level. you know, what I have an obligation to do is ask for a fiscal note for what it's going to cost the state. And I think, frankly, whatever the number is, I think the Department of Transportation probably is going to be the most affected by this because their concern about the cost is with strip takings and the attorney's fee provision more than anything else. And, you know, they do hundreds and hundreds of them every year. And their assumptions are that there's going to be a lot significantly more challenge to that than there is now. So no one has come to me to say, here's the number that we expect it's going to cost more for a city, for example.
One more question, sorry.
Very quickly,
thank you.
Over time.
Has there been a local fiscal note requested on the bill, or is there going to be one, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't intend to, but I think any chair can do that, or one can do that, probably. Okay.
Representative Wardlow, can your question come back tonight? Okay. All right. We're going to have Representative Johnson come back at 4:30, not tonight, but at 4:30. Representative Peterson, did you have something to this
point? Just a quick comment. I wanted to make it when Mr. Franklin was here.
Okay.
When I get an opportunity, I would like to speak in defense of the city of Richfield using eminent domain for economic development, and it will refer to the sod dealer that is his client. And I'll build you the argument why Richfield, like Brooklyn Center, needs the ability to reinvent itself from a 1951 filling station that has been abandoned and needs to be regrouped into a larger development. But I won't do it now, but I want Mr. Franklin to know I'm going to bring it up as a reason we need to preserve economic development.
Okay. Thank you. Members, if you could hold one sec. I'd like to get a sense from members, if we allow 1 hour more on this bill tonight at 4:30, is that, that's plenty, a half hour? Do I hear a half hour? 1 hour. Okay, we have a couple more people who'd like to testify, but we've had, I'm going to ask that it be maintained balance of for and against, so I'm going to limit it on that basis. We'll allow 1 hour, and I needed to be able to announce that so people who have their bills up tonight will know that there's an hour delay in the schedule. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chairman, 1 hour for discussion, but then we want to be able to discuss and not just have our questions of the testifiers be counted as the discussion. And so if we could get a sense of how many testifiers there might be and limit
so
the time that they're giving.
So far, Representative Hillstrom, I have one more. And that's on the opposing. Well, I have two more, but we've already had one for, one against. I'm going to allow one more against. When there's another one for, then I'll allow another one against.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Otherwise, I'd say maybe 30 minutes, no more than 30 minutes for testifiers, and at least 30 minutes of questions.
We should be well below that with one more. Meeting is recessed until this afternoon later at 4:30. Thank you for your perseverance, members. Right, and see you then. The local government committee meeting for March 13th is called back to order. It's well after 4:30. We reconvene the meeting, and Representative Johnson, I told everybody 5:30, we're 5 minutes late. We'll just go for 5:30, if that's all right.
That's fine with me.
Okay. Pardon? We have time for you now, Representative Wardlow. That's where we left off. We're ready. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, we spoke about this earlier briefly, and it's pretty much on the same lines as Lencheski's question about cities who've already spent quite a bit of money on redevelopment plans, and what happens, is there any, what are your views on maybe some sort of grandfather date so that TIF districts that are already in place, and we don't know whether we're talking TIFs that have been started or TIFs that have been certified, and letting them pursue and then have the bill apply to after March 1st or something like that. And the second part of that would be my Egan council, I met with him for like an hour and a half the next morning after the Apple Valley. And in fact, you spoke to one of the council members, the one who testified. And they were also concerned about possible lawsuits. I'm not quite sure where they were coming from with that. And also they were concerned that developers would stop wanting to develop in the area if they knew there was going to be huge problems. And those are some of the issues. My counsel came to me, even though I told him, hey, I like this bill. You know, I said, sure, I'll listen. So
okay.
That's my issues.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wardlow. And really, I think almost all of that goes back to what is the effective date, especially for TIF districts that are already, I don't know exactly where you draw the line on that, but that is, it's just an issue that I had not thought about, and so we'll work something out there. I'm pretty confident, and I've asked Representative Lincheski to try to come up with some language, and if you have some, that your city has suggested, I would really welcome seeing that. So we might even be able to work something out before committee on Wednesday and save some time.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we go to more questions, I'll put Representative Scalzi on the list and Representative Hillstrom. I want to finish up where we were this morning. And I have Mark Mandershed. If you'd come forward, please. And I understand Stephen Boudreau. Are you testifying together with Mr. Boubel, or are you guys there? Okay, I thought you guys were together, and then Keith Carlson of the last two groups to testify. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
I'm Mark Mandershide. I'm a resident of Mr. Paymire's district and an attorney with the law firm of Briggs & Morgan. I do a great deal of eminent domain work at all levels, primarily for the government on the right to take, but for both property owners and the government on valuation. There are some things that I think can be made much clearer if you are of a mind to change Minnesota statutes. First off, I wanted to talk about Section 4, attorney's fees. Let me give you an example of a case I've got right now representing a property owner. MnDOT has offered $300,000. They've already upped their offer to $410,000. That's more than 20%. And so at this point, I have no motivation whatsoever to settle the case. I might as well take it to trial because under this bill, I would already know my client would get their attorney's fees paid. I happen to think that's just bad policy. Policy, in my view, should encourage settlements, and I would strongly encourage you, if you are going to include a provision for attorney's fees, that provision should be something that kicks in using the commissioner's award as the lodestar, and it should have a requirement that says the property owner has to win the case. Let's take an example of where the government says the damages are $200,000 and the property owner says they're $1 million. If the commissioners come in at $250,000 or a jury comes in at $250,000, most people would say that the government won that case, but yet the midpoint between $200,000 and $1 million is $600,000. I would suggest to you that if you want the property owner to be able to recover attorney's fees, they should have to get to $600,000. You want to have the incentives in the right place, and as someone who tries cases, the incentives are not in the right place at this point, and you will have the unintended consequence of discouraging settlement, causing a lot more money, and having more cases go to commissioners and to trial. Section 7, compensation for loss of going concern. Loss of going concern is a rarity in the United States. It happens in only a few states. It happens in Minnesota now because we have a case, the Shutt case, decided by our Supreme Court several decades ago that says loss of going concern may be recovered. This bill would make it in statute, and that's fine if you as legislators want to put in the statute loss of going concern. But this bill, in terms of the way it does it, it's a nightmare. There is no discovery at the commission stage of the proceedings. No discovery. And so to put the burden on the government to come in, never having seen a financial statement, never having seen a tax return, never having seen the lease, never having seen anything about the business, knowing absolutely nothing about the business and suggesting that the government can even mount a case against that, I think that's in the wrong place. Historically, in the civil law, the party making the claim has the burden of proof. If a property owner wants to make a claim for loss of going concern, they're the ones who should have to prove their case. That's the way it's done in all the rest of the civil law, and I would would strongly urge you to switch it around, make it the other way. Some of these issues are fine to put in the statute, but it's the property owner who should have to make those claims. Section 8, minimum compensation. Frankly, I don't know what that means at this point. The standard in Minnesota since the beginning of statehood has been fair market value. We know what fair market value means. We bring in appraisers, we bring in engineers, we bring in designers, we bring in experts in the field. They provide us with this data, the information as to what market value is. I don't know what that means. In the case of homeowners, one of the things you should keep in mind is homeowners as well as businesses are entitled to relocation payments. A homeowner is entitled particularly to something called a replacement housing payment. What that says is that if there aren't any houses of the same size in the community and they want to stay in their community, that they can get paid an additional sum of money over and above fair market value so that they can buy replacement housing. That's already there as a part of the law for relocation. This is confusing. This would lead to double payment. For businesses, how do you tell what's comparable for a business? If someone has a small business on a small lot, what does this mean? How do you get to a building of equivalent size in the community? What if there aren't any? Is this for a determination of properties that are available for sale at the time of the taking, after the taking, what was available 2 years before the taking? What do you mean by owner? Owner, as it's defined earlier in this statute, says it's the tenant or it's the landlord. In this instance, if you mean owner, should a tenant be able to go out and buy a building? Most tenants have no interest in buying buildings. They're tenants for a reason. That's because they prefer to have their assets tied up in their inventory, in their sales. This definition, the way it works here, I urge you, rethink this one. I'm not sure what the intent was of this section, but you really need to rethink this one. And again, it's one of those things where if there is no discovery, and there isn't in condemnation cases until after an appeal to the district court, where is the government supposed to get any information? These proceedings are not proceedings where both parties are equally informed, and so making changes to the statute without understanding this disparity of information, you will create more litigation. There will be fewer settlements. Most eminent domain cases today settle. Only a few go to commissioners. Only a very few go to jury. I would encourage you to do what you can to put incentives in the right places so that as cases move along, there's incentive for settlement. Just a final comment in terms of the burden of proof, the standard. If you're intending to adopt a new statute, it's already going to have some new standards, again, to put a burden on the government for clear and convincing for a hearing that is held at a time when there's been no discovery, when there's no information, that makes it very difficult. If you decide that it is appropriate in certain instances for governments to be able to acquire properties, then set it up fairly, civil law standard, go forward from that and make sure the courts enforce those standards that you put into Minnesota law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Rubin, I understood you gentlemen were together, and I trust that you won't be repeating anything.
Yeah,
additional
correct.
Points to make?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Buble. I'm at Kennedy and Graven Law Firm. I am primarily a bond lawyer specializing in economic development and redevelopment. I'd like to speak particularly to the blight discussions in the bill. I have, for about 20 years, worked with local housing and redevelopment authorities and cities and economic development authorities on helping put projects together, negotiate contracts, identify the situations where redevelopment can and can't be done. And I'd like to speak to what, from my experience, what the impact of some of these changes and these definitions would be. First, in the definition of a blighted area, which requires under the bill, this is all in Section 2 of the bill, the requirement that more than 50% of the buildings are dilapidated. And dilapidated has a number of criteria, which in my view exists very, very rarely, almost anywhere in Minnesota. The first one is that the building had been cited for building code violations in the last year, and that those violations have not been remedied within the time period that was stated. From my both my personal experience in working with projects, I can't think of a project where any of the buildings had that condition, let alone 50%. I've had many discussions with building officials who have indicated that the way this works in the real world is, in commercial properties, for example, most building code issues only come up by complaint. Most building officials are not out going through buildings every single day. One exception might be cities that happen to have rental licensing, and they may have an annual inspection. So apartment buildings may get an order to correct something, and that's invariably corrected within 30 to 60 days. A handful of cities have on residential properties, some said residential, they may have point-of-sale ordinances that require some inspections. But again, the result is not generally a citation for a violation that goes unremedied. So this is just a circumstance that, for the most part, doesn't exist. And part of the reason it doesn't exist is that cities work pretty hard for these things not to happen, or else we just don't know about them, because you just don't get inside buildings that often. The second prong of this is probably even more significant, which is that the building be unfit for human use because it's unsafe, structurally unsound, or lacking in basic equipment. Again, this is a condition that, in my experience, exists very, very rarely. The only ones that I have ever seen are actually not part of traditional redevelopment projects. These are mainly residential properties, the so-called garbage houses, the severely hazardous substandard houses, which are not dealt with, frankly, under Chapter 469 and in the redevelopment context. They are dealt with under Chapter 463, which is a separate statute that has been available for many, many years to deal with those kind of situations. And it may not involve, in fact, typically doesn't involve actual condemnation. It usually involves going to court to get an order to correct the problem or maybe to raise the building. That situation is already addressed. But to impose that requirement in the redevelopment context would, in my experience, mean that you just really would not have very much true redevelopment going on. That's just the reality as I have seen it. Another criteria, which interestingly is not part of blighted area, is abandoned buildings, which again, it's a fairly tough test. It says that you actually can't find the owner of the building. Again, a pretty unusual circumstance. And I think it's worth noting that abandoned, even if you could meet that test, it's not really part of the definition of a blighted area, because that says you have to have 50% of your buildings that are meet this dilapidated test. Well, what happens if you have some that met that very tight dilapidated test and some that were abandoned? That still wouldn't count because you haven't been able to look at them together. And this is in comparison to the way most redevelopment projects are done now, is your cities are attacking an area-wide basis, looking at what may be a myriad of problems. And there aren't easy answers, and it's not black and white in most situations. Another point in Section 3, which is highly significant, is the requirement for an extremely high standard for acquiring non-dilapidated buildings, non-properties. Essentially, this provision would indicate that those could not be taken unless it's absolutely necessary in order to remove the dilapidated buildings. Well, absolute necessity is a standard that, unless it's absolutely necessary in order to remove the dilapidated buildings. Well, absolute necessity is a standard that I'm not familiar with in most statutes. If we take it as it were, it seems to mean what it says, absolutely necessary, which probably just means if you've got a building that has, they have a common wall, and you literally cannot remove the dilapidated building without, or the non-blighted building without taking down the one next to it. In reality, there is certainly a great deal of necessity in assembling parcels to do redevelopment projects, but it's because of the practical reality that you can't simply come in one area and remove one building and do a significant redevelopment, whether it be a commercial or a residential type development, and leave other parcels that are there. Sometimes it's for physical reasons, sometimes it's for economic reasons, that in order for a project to actually work financially, feasibly, you simply have to assemble parcels. Whether that would be the absolute necessity test, I don't know. My guess is probably not. So again, I think what we're saying is we're abandoning a fairly long tradition in Minnesota of looking at redevelopment on an area-wide basis rather than on a piecemeal basis, which in the past policy has been to recognize that that's a problem. And my last point is the evidentiary standard, which Mr. Mandishai mentioned as well, covers all takings. Presumably that seems to cover these findings as well, the findings that you've met these tests, these dilapidated buildings, abandoned buildings, whatever, again, a very, very tight test, adding on to it this clear and convincing standard, which is really just one step down from beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, a test that no one knows exactly how it would met. It's a standard that is in civil law is pretty much used in cases of fraud situations like that. That would be sort of unprecedented. And again, the expectation is that this would be a very rare finding, and eminent domain for redevelopment would be extremely rare in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Buble.
Thank you.
Keith Carlson, welcome to the committee, and state your name. You may proceed.
Members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association that consists of five counties here in the metropolitan area and eight in greater Minnesota. I'm going to talk about a subject that, frankly, has received scant attention. I've attended most of your hearings in Rochester, Sartell, your hearing out in Brooklyn Center, as well as one other one, and that's the effect of this legislation on acquisitions of properties for traditional governmental purposes, for governmental facilities, for parks, and most importantly, from my members' perspective, county's perspective, roads and highways. This bill will have substantial effects in terms of increasing the cost and the times for those acquisitions. Before I touch on my particular comments, I just want to make clear what the current process is. For transportation-related acquisitions, our first duty is to hand our appraisal to the owner of the property. There's no hidden agenda when we start negotiation with individuals. We have a duty to provide that appraisal. And in most instances, at least for my members, those appraisals are done by independent appraisers. We are not buying a cheap or lowball appraisal. We are buying something from a professional who has to abide by the canons of his or her profession in preparing that. Secondly, we have to try and negotiate. We have a duty, again, under the statute, to try and negotiate. In doing that negotiation, we have to inform the individual that he or she has the opportunity to get his or her own appraisal, and we will reimburse them for that cost and the amount of reimbursement. We agreed to increase more than triple that 4 years ago from $500 to $1,500. Finally, we have to take into account any appraisal that they may have in their hands in coming up with a negotiated price. Just one final point. In the context of attorney fees, you've heard frequently that the decks are all stacked in our favor. I'll point out, too, it's just as difficult for us and, frankly, as expensive for us to go to the condemnation commissioner's hearing or, worse, the court, as it is for the owner. It does cost us time and money for either our staff or for hiring outside counsel, and it's something that we try and avoid and do, usually in most circumstances, acquiring most of our properties from 85 to 95% of the time. I'm now going to refer to, I think, a document that's handed out to most of you, been handed out to the committee. It says, concerns about proposed eminent domain changes. Both bills that you've been hearing in your evening hearings last week, Representative Johnson's bill and Representative Nelson's, will increase our right-of-way cost. However, Representative Johnson's bill will increase our cost far more. For example, the attorney's fees provision alone has been testified by DOT in previous committees to cost them over $14 million a year, or 20% of their acquisition costs. A local impact note has been requested on this subject, and unfortunately, because of new staffing over at the Department of Finance, they've been a little bit slow in getting that compiled, but we will ultimately respond, and I'm sure our costs will equal or exceed that. Those additional costs will mean that much less in additional roads and road improvements in Minnesota, and that's not insignificant. It's just like cutting the gas tax and the motor vehicle license fees that are distributed to us for right-of-way acquisitions by 20%. Further, the compensation for going concern provision will cost us additional money and further decrease the amount of roads and road improvements that will occur in Minnesota. It will also Both bills will also increase the amount of time for those acquisitions. However, again, Representative Johnson's bill will increase those times substantially more. Basically, by setting this 20% threshold at which point attorney's fees will be awarded to the owner, you've basically set a benchmark to which all negotiations will ultimately be going to from the point of the view of the owner and the attorneys. They're always going to hold out for 20% in order to get the attorney's fees paid for by the local government or the state. That means it's just going to extend the amount of time that we'll be engaged in negotiations or have to wait until the condemnation commissioners or courts finally set it. Going concern is also a problem in that regard because determining that is a quite protracted and litigious matter right now in courts, and I'm certain the same is going to be true with regards to doing it for eminent domain. Both bills will make changes in the eminent domain process. However, in this respect, I believe Representative Johnson's bill is the more far-reaching and more appropriate. However, there is a timing issue. Representative Johnson's additional hearing requirement applies to all eminent domain provisions, but there's no coordination with the existing process. It's quite possible that the petition could be filed to initiate the eminent domain process with the courts, and the local government will not have yet held its hearings because it's not required to, and that frankly doesn't make any sense. The hearing should come first, and then the eminent domain petition's filing should follow it. I will, to speak to Representative Nelson's bill, commend to you several provisions in there that I think are superior to the Johnson bill because, frankly, they're not subjects that are mentioned whatsoever in the bill. First, the Nelson bill requires disclosure of the acquiring entity's appraisal to the property owner. That's required right now for transportation-related acquisitions, but all other acquisitions, that's not required. Nor is that required of all entities, for example, public utilities and pipelines. They don't have to share their appraisal with the property owner until perhaps they reach the condemnation commissioner's hearings. Also, Representative Nelson's bill is the only one to require good faith negotiations, which I commend to you to consider. Finally, my written comments, only House File 2895, Representative Nelson's bill, increases the appraisal reimbursement or requires them in some instances to be paid at all. The $1,500 appraisal reimbursement that I previously touched on is raised to $5,000 in Representative Nelson's bill for businesses and apartments, and quite frankly, we concede that that's appropriate. And in some instances, it would require that a reimbursement for the first time. Again, for public utilities and pipelines, for example, they're not required to pay a reimbursement whatsoever unless the issue ultimately reaches the condemnation commissioners. I'll just finally close with a few follow-up comments to Mr. Manderscheid's remarks. I agree completely with his remarks regarding going concern. The appropriate entity to bear the burden of proof as to whether going concern should be paid is the property owner, not the acquiring entity to disprove whether or not destruction of the business and loss of going concern has occurred. Further, I'd like to commend to you changes that were at least partially made to the Senate. The appropriate venue for making this a determination is the courts. Condemnation commissioners are realtors and appraisers. They have expertise in determining the value of bricks and mortar of lands and building. They don't have expertise in determining the value of a business. And I strongly suggest to you that both the determination of whether an award of going concern should be made and whether and what that amount should be is appropriately resides with the court, who has seen litigations of that issue in other venues within their within their courtrooms. On the minimum damage awards, I also heartily agree with Mr. Manderscheid's comments. We are already under that obligation for purposes of homes, and it's difficult to see how this concept would be put into effect with regards to businesses. With that, I'll conclude my comments and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you. Members, at this point, I want to note in your packet, there's a memo from House Research. Make sure you see that because it's a response from Ms. Dyson to the questions that were raised at the hearings on Wednesday and Thursday. So that you see that. Note that for the record. And with that, Representative Scalzi, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for Representative Johnson, and this is just a dovetailing on Lynn Wardlow's comments regarding TIF. I've had requests from some cities that have been assembling properties, not thinking of using eminent domain, but they've been assembling properties, and it may not be in a TIF district, but if they've been assembling properties, there may be some tax dollars that have been used and would be lost if this whole completed area with no development in mind would be disregarded, and that would be for sort of blighted areas, but maybe wouldn't meet the definition, for instance, a metal building or something that burned in the past and has, and I think it could be defined by either minutes or memos, and I'm just wondering if those could possibly be grandfathered in to state that the process would have started before March 1st, 2006, and it could be verified by memos and letters and meetings, et cetera, for cities that have tried to do the right thing and working with all the parties involved. May not be a TIF district. I'm just kind of throwing that out because that's been brought to my attention.
Okay. Thank you. And
Representative Johnson.
Representative Scalzi, I'm happy to look at that as well. That, I mean, it kind of goes back to, again, that same issue of effective date, and maybe we may be farther than a TIF district, but I'm happy to consider that.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had requested of staff to find out. I had brought up the issue of my community going after a property owner, them being cited for code violations, going to court, and the court finding, giving a fine to the property owner but not requiring the cleanup. And so that is, in fact, the case in the law. While the court has the ability to require the property to be repaired or cleaned up, it doesn't require that. And so the judge does have within his discretion to just simply fine the property owner and not require remediation of the problem. So as you move forward looking at that issue, I hope that you'll take that into account.
I will.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, on the question of compensation for going concern was brought up. Would compensation for going concern in your bill be available to a tenant who is displaced?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, that is not how I would read the language, although I got to look at this a little more closely, but we define this as a business or a trade that is completely taken, so it's not a strip taking or anything like that, and it only applies to a business or a trade. So I don't believe it would.
But my question is, thank you. People have been using Richfield, Minnesota as the bad boy of condemnation, and I have observed that closely for many years, know it intimately well, and I'm here to defend their honor of having done a marvelous job of redevelopment. And one of the things that they redeveloped was a commercial property on Lindale and 494. It was owned by a Rosemont owner who's never spent any money fixing it up. And one of the tenants in it was replaced because of the condemnation by Richfield was the Bunny Hutch, which was a very disreputable entity that the landlord kept trying to kick out, but they could never get it done. Now, the way I'm reading your bill, the Bunny Hutch would also have a going concern issue because they'd have to leave that, would have to have left that property and been relocated. I mean, but yours doesn't address the fact that historically the bill says that only the landlord, the owner of the property is dealt with in a condemnation. The tenants really don't have rights. So I need to understand where you're coming from on
tenants, because the way it reads now, everybody in Adelman's building would have been subject to relocation. And most of them were there because the rent was cheap. They could get away with all kinds of things they couldn't get done anyplace else. And it was the front door of Richfield, and Richfield wanted to clean it up. And your bill would never allow Richfield to do it. It would be dead in the water.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson. Well, and you know, I haven't looked at the particular issue of a tenant or not. That's not how I read it, but we certainly can clarify that before we get to the floor to make sure I'm reading it consistently with what Senator Bach, for example, over in the Senate thinks and others in the coalition. But with respect to being able to eliminate a building or a business in order to clean up the entrance to the city, or we heard about a couple of projects, you know, that are considered gateways to different cities. And I would beg to differ that all of a sudden none of this is going to happen anymore. I think it was Representative Marquardt who said, you know, it'd be nice to take a look at all these same pictures and get the opinion of the author of the bill as to whether they actually, none of these things would have happened anymore. And, you know, there may be some of them that wouldn't have. And I don't know nearly enough about this particular project, but you know, I think, that the definition of a public nuisance is relatively broad under the law. And as I've also mentioned, our definition of blight is probably going to be broadened a bit, so we're not talking, as somebody was testifying, towards unfit for human use. That's probably not where we're going to end up, and my intent is on Wednesday to change that. So while this is going to make eminent domain for economic development more difficult, absolutely, and I think that's a good thing, because I think that it's much too loose right now. It's going to far from eliminate it, as some people have suggested. I think when, you know, we've had people get up here and say economic development in Minnesota is going to stop or it's going to be ended. That's ridiculous. It's not. Before we had an expansive definition of eminent domain in Minnesota, we had plenty of economic development back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it's really been the last couple decades where we've seen it, where we've seen the definition be expanded as far as it is now. So, you know, in a nutshell, yes, it's going to be harder, but I don't think it's going to eliminate many of these economic development or redevelopment projects that can be very worthwhile.
Representative Peterson. Other discussion. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, just a question on the attorney's fees. I like the approach that you're trying to take just to make sure that there's honest negotiation in the process. But when I look at it, I also think that it should be reciprocal, in which oftentimes I think people think cities have deep pockets. But in recent years with LGA cuts and additional mandates, it's oftentimes not the case. Do you believe that there should also be provisions in there saying that the last request by a property owner, if determined to be the reward was 20% lower than the request, then the attorney's fee should be reimbursed to the condemning entity?
Representative Johnson.
Chairman, Representative Haas, I don't. I don't at all, in fact, because I see it. There's a significant difference there. One is the government entity that's trying to take something away from a person. And the other is somebody who's trying to protect their right to have that or to get just compensation. So, I mean, the two players in this picture are in such a completely different position that what I'm trying to do here is level the playing field a little bit. And while I know that there are cities that are going through some very tough times right now, compared to an average citizen, almost any city has deep pockets, because if they have to, they can find the money by taxing people for it. Where most property owners, this isn't even a dream of them to be able to come up with $20,000 or $40,000 or $60,000. So I don't agree with that, just because I think that one person is trying to protect essentially his or her constitutional rights, and the other is trying to take someone's land from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the reply, Representative Johnson. I think there's sometimes a difference, though, between just compensation and excessive compensation requests. And I just want to, and maybe what I brought out isn't the right approach, but I would like to see, you know, a mechanism that allows you know, constructive negotiations in the process without lowballing and without excessive demands for compensation to try to work out an agreement beforehand. I mean, that's the ultimate goal. So I don't know if I have the clear and correct answer yet, but I'd like to see something worked out. Because I do like the attorney fee provision. It's fair. But there should also be something on the other side.
Representative Hoss, just the attorney fee part, there's been a lot of conversation about that. It's a controversial piece of the bill. I think it's a really important piece, but not completely wedded to the way we've done it. So there may be some other options there. I think encouraging people to talk, and I think Mr. Manderscheid actually had a couple of good suggestions there. Encouraging people to talk and get more information is a good thing. So I'm open to that.
Further discussion? Any further discussion on the bill? Well, I think we've given enough hearing time. Representative Johnson, do you have any other comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, other than that, I appreciate the time, and I look forward to Wednesday. And if I could just ask, for those that do have amendments, you obviously don't have to show them to me, but if anybody's willing to do that, I just think I've been very open to looking at these things, and the earlier we can sit down and talk about potential amendments, you know, the less time you'll probably have to spend here on Wednesday.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Representative Johnson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a procedural question. With the 24-hour rule, what time tomorrow would amendments be due by?
We've changed it so many times. Our administrator tells me that we had already set 4 o'clock.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then at 4 o'clock, would all the amendments be then available to any member of the committee who wants to go pick them up and take a look at them?
As far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
That's been the spirit of what we're doing.
Okay. And then one last question, Mr. Chair. If there was a number of testifiers who presented information, for example, I had a constituent who had to leave and was not able to say and give his testimony, but he submitted it in writing, at what point will those additional pieces of information be provided to committee members?
Representative Hillstrom, I have it written right here. That was my next announcement.
Great.
And it's I checked with Mary Cummins, and that will be done tomorrow morning. And I apologize that it's not yet been done.
Okay.
They just didn't get to it. And appreciate you highlighting that issue.
Okay.
So the packets of what's already been submitted in the two previous evening hearings will be copied and handed out to members tomorrow morning. So, one note about when we get the amendments, there has to be a certain amount of time. In fact, President Lennon says 5 o'clock and Mary says 4 o'clock, and I think we should say 4 o'clock because there needs to be some time for Mary to copy them and make them available to members to see so that she doesn't have to stay after 5 o'clock every single night. If that's reasonable... Representative Lanning.
We publicly announced 5 o'clock.
Yeah. Can we publicly change it?
You're the boss.
No, the committee's the boss. We'll just work with it as best we can. And if members get them in early, that would be appreciated so Mary can copy them and have them available as soon as possible. In the same spirit, the author of the bill would like to see them. I know others would like to see them, and I do think that helps the process so that we can work on things ahead of time and save committee time. So they'll still be taking it by, but you have to bear in mind that we can't just immediately turn around and hand them out, but they have to be copied and so forth. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Representative Johnson. It'll be a fun day on Wednesday. Just like it has been all along. Great process. Representative Hoppe. Hey, your time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll need slightly more than that, but not much more.
Okay, Representative Hoppe. You go to the General Register?
Going to the General Register.
Okay, the Chair moves that House File 3142 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Hoppe, the bill is before us. Representative Hoppe had an agreement with
Representative Abrams and Representative Seifert to bring his bill up first because of schedule matter. So you'll find it lower in the packet. Representative Hoppe, see your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for deviating from your schedule. This is the essence of a non-controversial bill. This is correcting in statute one instance that we forgot to change last year in a non-controversial bill where we changed Hennepin Parks to Three Rivers Parks only in statute. It's already been changed on the signs and vehicles and things like that. We realized it, but we couldn't correct it in last year's revisor's bill, so we have to have a brand new bill to correct it. And members, that's the essence of the bill.
Questions to Representative Hoppe?
Thank you for your support.
Representative Hoppe and members,
I'd like to suggest
any discussion about putting this on the consent calendar?
That'd be fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Any objections to putting it on the consent calendar? Okay. The chair will amend his motion. I'll just change the motion. This was my motion. That the House file, excuse me.
3142.
I've got too many papers moving here. Amend my motion to House file 3142 be recommended to pass and be sent to the general register to be put on the consent calendar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill will be passed and sent to the general register to be put on the consent calendar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think I inverted that, but that worked. Yeah, it should have been recommended. Yeah, it should be placed. I inverted that. All right. Okay, is Representative Seifert here?
I just
walked up
on the first floor.
Yeah, we're moving faster.
I could talk more if you want.
And Representative Abrams is not. Representative Seifert's bill is going to be moved to higher ed. Is John Corbett in the audience? Do you come forward, please? And then there's supposed to be a representative from the Minsky Student Association. Okay. So we're prepared. The chair will move that House File 3169 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Higher Education Policy Committee. Mr. Corbett, is there any concern with you beginning testimony before the author of the bill gets here, or that you're aware of?
That the chairman not would be, but Representative Seifert might be nervous. No.
Oh, I don't feel any nervous.
Just kidding. He'll be fine.
Any members have an objection?
Go on.
Okay. We'll keep it rolling. He'll be here any minute, so.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Corbett, and I represent here today the Minnesota Private College Council, which is an association of the 17 private baccalaureate degree schools in Minnesota. We're here to support House File 3169, but I'd like to state that we do understand the pressures that take place on local units of government to provide services and the financing pressures that they're under. However, we think that the fees on students are not the way to address that problem. Students come in, I think, four main categories. First one is the residents of the community. And they're not just the children of residents of the community. Average age of students in Minnesota is growing all the time. And I think the average age in many of the schools is in the upper 20s. But if they are residents of the community, they're paying property taxes. They're property taxpayers. If you're renters in that community, they're also property taxpayers. If you're a commuter, you're no different than any other citizen who comes in from one of the suburbs or one of the country places to do business in that town. And cities are always trying to convince folks to come and do business in their community. So that leaves a category of dormitory residents, and we have to say that those folks are using some services. We think the cost of those services is offset by the higher property values of both residences and businesses in campus neighborhoods. And finally, I believe a per capita fee is a regressive tax, in that it is a greater burden on low-income students than on more prosperous ones. And unfortunately, these fees will get passed on to students in the form of tuition or costs they would pass on to them. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Seifert, apologize.
Well, that's okay.
Things went quicker, which is not always what we expect.
Okay.
If you want to just quickly speak to your bill, and then we'll
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, do you have a motion to send it to higher ed?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. Members, this is something that popped up not overly long ago. It's an issue that relates to assessing a fee, I guess you'd call, against college students just for the sake of them being college students, not for any other reason. It is something that I'm a little nervous about, that if this trend would start, that it would never stop. And a lot of colleges located throughout the state would have this imposed upon them by local governments for whatever reason. And it could be local government aid. It could be a variety of reasons local governments might come up with in terms of an idea. I realize this isn't in place yet anywhere, and some people say, well, why are you doing this? And the reason is if you start this somewhere and they get addicted to the money, it is never going to stop. And I like the idea of having this as a preventative measure before anybody even gets into the business of assessing dollars against college students or institutions, that the legislature step in and just say, this is not the policy that we see as a positive thing as, on a statewide basis. Not have a hodgepodge around the state or whatnot. There are a lot of universities clustered around the state. St. Paul, I believe, has more higher education available per capita than any other community of its metropolitan counterparts, except for Boston, Massachusetts. So there is a lot of higher education clustered in the city of St. Paul, and I understand that it might be a tempting source of revenue for local governments that are starving for cash. And some people might make the argument that, you know, there are more police calls or something, but if you take a look at what McAllister did, they actually found out that MAC students were 34 times less likely than the average citizen to require police services. And there are a lot of universities now, most of the universities that are four-year right now, that have their own security force on campus. The campus that I work at in Marshall, for example, we have our own security that takes care of most problems. You know, there might be some things that are get to be quite large that they can't handle, but in most cases, the majority of cases, campus security can handle most of the incidents that arise. So members, I would ask, before this even gets started or off the ground or even gets to be more than a twinkle in some city council member's eye, that before this moves forward and gets to have an impetus for whatever reason, that the legislature would say, we just don't think that this is a wise policy to get involved with. And Mr. Corbett, I believe, already testified, so I don't know if there's anyone else to testify, but I'd ask that you give it a nod of the head and move it on to higher education. But we do have some Minsky students, I believe, that would like to testify.
Yes, Representative Paymore, you have a question?
I have a comment. I don't know if we want to take the testimony first, and I'll be happy
Let's take the testimony first. Mr. Jordan Brandt?
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jordan Brandt, the Vice President of the Minnesota State Colleges Student Association. And unfortunately, my colleagues from the Minnesota State University's Student Association are unable to be here today, as they're in Washington, D.C., and asked me to speak on their behalf. Collectively, I'll be representing 170,000 students' voices. And as students, we're very thankful of Representative Seifert for introducing this bill. When we first learned of the St. Paul City Council's proposal of implementing a $25 fee on college students, we were very disappointed. We see this as a tax on students. When students in the Minnesota state colleges and university systems are struggling to pay a 62% increase on tuition over the past 5 years, we cannot afford any additional fees. We've heard that this issue was brought before the St. Paul City Council, which felt the city's police, firemen, and first responders spend a disproportionate amount of time at campuses dealing with resident issues. This is a particular concern to two-year students, since the majority of us do not live on campus. Also, many of us are city residents that already contribute to local taxes in many ways. Implementing yet another fee on students is unjust, unfair, and in our opinion, unwarranted. Our association feels so strongly on this issue, we've made it one of our top three legislative priorities. We appreciate Representative Seifert's bill saying that no city should implement a fee on college students. The higher education community, whether the institution is public or private, two-year or four, greatly contributes to local economies. We train people for future careers that fulfill the state's vital workforce needs. We also give graduates an opportunity to secure better-paying jobs in which they contribute more to state and local taxes. This benefits everyone. Please stand with Representative Seifert in support of this bill. With the rising debt of students, the last thing we need is another fee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. questions of Mr. Brandt? Representative Seifert, do you have any other people that wish to testify on behalf of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. Is there anyone out there that wants to testify? These are the two that we had contacted. We're not able to get a hold of the U of M Student Association, but I believe they're going to have someone at the Higher Education Committee, Mr. Chair.
Does anyone wish to speak in opposition to this proposed bill? If not, Representative Baymore.
I would like to speak in opposition to the bill, Mr. Chair. It just boggles my mind sometimes when the very members who seem to espouse the rhetoric that we should have local control are the very ones that come here time after time and try and preempt local control. Councilmember Bedenoff proposed this ordinance, and the rest of the council decided that it wasn't timely to do it for a variety of reasons. You know, this is a local control issue. It's up to the city of St. Paul and the private colleges in our community to make these decisions. And they're not easy ones. You know, the city of St. Paul, Representative Seifert, is facing a $20 million deficit this year. We've taken, since the legislature and the governor have made the LGA cuts, we've lost $73 million in LGA since 2003. Do other cities face similar losses and difficulties? Of course they do, but it's been particularly hard on our city. I would point out to you, Representative Seifert, that in 2005 there were 1,000 calls. You made the statement that campus security could handle all these calls, or handle most of them, I think that's what you said. The police and fire in the city of St. Paul were called out 1,000 times in 2005 to the St. Paul colleges for police and fire calls. So you have to look at it from our perspective. I hope you would look at it from our perspective. If we lose another $20 million out of the budget, you know, we've already got a levy increase that's going to happen. The only thing that the city and the city council can do is start the layoffs in police and fire. That's just the reality of it, unless there's some type of LGA assistance in this legislative session. So I'm particularly proud of our city. I mean, we have, you know, great colleges and universities. I have several in my district, and McAllister is, you're from Mac?
Mm-hmm. A student?
I thought you were a Mac student. Yeah, if you were a Mac student, you might support the, you might be opposed to this. But,
he likes you.
You know, it's a fairness issue, and the fee is not, it's not a fee that the students would pay. It would be calculated for each college in the city of St. Paul. So I would just ask the the committee to reject the Seifert Amendment bill. I mean, there's no city that's doing it yet. If the city of St. Paul can figure out a fair and equitable way of doing it, then let our city try to do it. In the meantime, there's no ordinance. And I would add that in Boston, that has, as you already mentioned, Representative Seifert, that has a lot of private colleges, they have an in lieu of tax program for their colleges there, and they raise a significant amount of money because it does cost our city's money to have private colleges in our communities. It's not that we don't want them; it's great that you know it adds to our community and we'll support them in any way we can. In Boston, as a matter of fact, they're thinking of, in addition to the in lieu of tax, they're thinking of charging $100 per student. So I think it's a matter of shrinking resources for our communities. This may be a way that we look at it in the future. It may not be the way, the Benninoff ordinance may not be the way that we're going, as was evidenced by the fact that he was not able to get enough council approval. But let's not tie the hands of city government. Let's let city government find creative and innovative ways of working on raising the necessary revenue that they need. And it might not be this approach, but I think this bill is not the right approach either. So I would urge the committee to reject the Seifert bill.
Representative Seifert, did you wish to respond?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that the students in St. Paul and in places like Minneapolis, Duluth, Mankato, St. Cloud do provide a lot of revenue, and it's the local option sales tax that, but for these universities, you would have thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, it's probably millions, thousands of students that would not be paying into these revenue streams just for the simple fact. One of my college professor friends who serves in the legislature, Representative Sharon, would probably attest that the Perkins in his neighborhood down by the Golden Bears probably wouldn't even be open if it were not for the university community in that area. Most university towns in the state of Minnesota have a local option sales tax of some sort that are of significant size. And in my opinion, there is a lot of revenue derived in the terms of millions that is spent, and that we shouldn't go back and take from those who are least able to pay, which tend to be college students, and force them to pay in. And I know a lot of people say, well, college students won't vote, and they're only going to be in your district for 2 years, so it's really easy to nick at them and be able to do something like imposing some sort of per student or per university fee. But, the bottom line is it the right thing to do? Politically, I'm sure people can get by doing stuff like this to college students. I just don't see it as the proper way to do it. And it is a matter of state policy. We always worship at the altar of local control when it's convenient, but then when it's something that we don't like, then we say, well, we should have a statewide standard of some sort. So, some of us like local control and smoking bans, and then the rest of us will say, no, we don't want a hodgepodge. This should be state policy. We can find 100 different bills where everybody in this room has probably voted differently on each one of them because of our philosophy, our thought process in terms of what should be local control and what should be state policy. In a lot of cases, is this something that's going on right now? And I'd say, thank heavens it's not going on right now, because once people start taxing or feeing, they get addicted to the revenue and you will never get rid of it. I can't say that this legislature or the legislature before this or the one before this has done wonderful and marvelous things for higher ed. I think we did a lot of good things last year as compared to 2003 in terms of trying to provide more appropriations for higher education. But this is one thing we can do in this short session to say, hey, we did something to protect students, because we just haven't done enough of that.
Representative Hodge?
I put that on my letter.
Right down the recording at 5:35 p.m.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to try to keep this brief, because this is an issue that's near and dear to me, and one that I've struggled with trying to balance when I was mayor of St. Joseph. There are significant burdens brought upon by our colleges, but at the same time, wonderful economic advantages provided. One of the things that I've had that's very frustrating is the college in my home
district is trying to require students to live all 4 years onto their campus. There are empirical evidence to show that there is a huge burden on our local police and fire when our students are also in the city. And again, I don't want to sound negative because they're my favorite people and I'm a product of those institutions. But it is frustrating. And just to put it into perspective, St. Joseph is in the bottom fifth percentile of property taxes per capita, but we are in the top 50th percentile on property tax rate. The burdens are very significant. And when you have to buy a $300,000 ladder truck, and the only buildings that that ladder truck serves in that whole community is on the colleges, and you can't get a dime out of them, it's frustrating. But at the same time, I don't think that the city should be given unilateral authority just to impose a fee. What I believe we need to do is work with administration and try to come to a consensus of saying, how do we fairly work with administration and the college students to be an entire community? And I just want to make sure, would this prevent cities and colleges working together of possibly implementing a fee if the administration were to agree to do so?
Yeah. Representative Cipher?
Mr. Chair, in reading this, I mean, voluntarily you can pay anything that you want, but this would not allow for a city, county, or town to just impose some type of assessment, either on a person or on an institution. If you can work out something voluntarily, I don't think that this is going to preclude anything because it's going to be a voluntarily agreed to item, but this would not allow for something. The key word in 1.7 is impose, and you know, the thing is the lever kind of moves towards the university side under this bill. Obviously, right now the lever is more tilted towards the local government.
Representative Hosh, did you follow up?
If that is so the case, I can support this. It's one of those things that, you know, I don't think carte blanche authority should be given to the city to keep raising fees or imposing fees with no limit. But at the same time, I know through discussions with my local universities is that there's been a big push by administration to say we want enforcement on rental homes or we want enforcement on underage drinking, and we have simply not been able to meet that with a lot of our cuts. So, I mean, if the city can say, well, we can work with the colleges on what they want to see enforced more specifically, if they're willing to impose a fee or to work together, I think that's only fair. And also, the students are able to have input at the same process with their administration. So as long as this doesn't prevent cooperative relationships into imposing some kind of fee if they choose to do so, I think it's reasonable.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And it is kind of a sad state of affairs when you do have city council members even thinking about an idea like this. But as Representative Paymar said, the local government aid cuts have led councils to look at this type of thing. And I agree wholeheartedly with Representative Paymar. We need to get more dollars in the local government aid. But having said that, the fee itself, I think, is pretty unfair. As Mr. Brandt there said, many of the college students don't live in the dorms or live in the city already and are paying the due amount. And also, in the local government aid need factor, there was something added in 2003 which was called the road accident factor, which was to try to increase the need and ultimately dollars in local government aid based on, well, I think it was mainly to help regional cities and those with colleges where you have more traffic of people coming in and then leaving. So even though there isn't enough as far as the level of local government aid, they've tried to look at the formula to try to compensate, and maybe we need to even do more in that regard dealing with colleges. And finally, as far as border communities like Moorhead, there's a tough enough time to keep a lot of the college students on the Minnesota side, not only in the dorms, but just going to the school. And granted, $25, you know, probably wouldn't be cost prohibitive, but like you say, when you add that on top of 62% over the last 4 years, and just kind of the image that the state or communities are doing this, I know would drive students
across the river into our neighboring part. So I agree with much of what Representative Paymar is saying as far as the need and why this probably came about. I agree with the bill that I don't like cities imposing fees on college students. So I'm going to vote yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, a couple of comments, maybe a question for the author. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to this, at least line 1-9 and 1-10, which is a person's status based on being a student. And if we've had the 62% increase in tuition and other fees over the last 5 years, as Mr. Brandt said, can't afford any other increase in fees, I think there is a regressive tax on students. However, the part that I'm concerned about is maybe there's another way to assess colleges as an institution besides directly going into the wallets of these individual students. And I guess, you know, if there's a way to do that, and I don't know if this interferes with nonprofit status or the tax status of a public institution, is there a way to at least, you know, account for some of these increased costs that universities have on local governments, but not really going directly to the students? I mean, is that, I'm not sure if there's a way to do that, Representative Seifer, because I am sympathetic to, you know, your argument and Mr. Brandt's argument about student fees and imposing this additional. Is there another way to do this?
Representative
Seifer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hornstein, I've thought about this. I've thought about, you know, is there a way of doing something where, you know, there's some other, and I mean, the money has to come from somewhere if a local government is looking at doing this. And the thought process as well, just to charge it to the institution, but anyone in the right mind is going to say the institution is not, they aren't going to eat it, they're going to pass it on to someone. It's just like when you mandate something on a business, they're going to increase their prices, and somehow it's going to have to be paid for by somebody. If they paid for it out of the foundation generally is there for scholarships, and so you're generally just taking it away from the students out of the left pocket instead of the right pocket. And I have thought about this. I had over 4 hours this morning on my usual 2-hour and 50-minute commute up here to think about this. And I, you know, I just can't. If the money has to is being demanded from somewhere, it's got to come from somewhere, and I just don't see another way around this. You know, we did Representative Lanning actually was kind enough to have a little research done on this earlier, and there is no clear authority on whether something like this can even be done right now by local governments. But I think we should, just as a policy matter, as legislators, say this is something that we don't see as a direction that they should be going.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, and I don't know, don't want to be careful when I use the S word, meaning stadium, but I'm not sure if we're going to see the U of M stadium in this committee. And again, I think the U of M has taken an approach that's commendable as compared to the other professional teams in terms of having a 60% share, you know, in terms of non-state subsidy. But when I looked at that a little more closely, I think $53 million was student fees. And that seems extraordinary, particularly in the context of Mr. Brandt's comments. And I'm very concerned about that. And I hope that, you know, when we look at student fees, we'll also be sympathetic to, you know, the U of M students who I think are going to be, at least in the current plan, paying, I think, far out of proportion for that particular facility. So I just wanted to point that out, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifer.
Mr. Chairman, the difference in terms of this bill prohibiting that is that the institution itself to the regents are imposing the fee,
right,
for the stadium versus the local government, Minneapolis, in this particular case. But I do sympathize with what you're saying, that it does seem to be a pretty heavy burden to pay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, to that point? Just to that point?
Representative Graffel.
My understanding was is that the elected student leaders of the student body had approved that as well. That was my understanding, so that would be a distinct difference.
Representative Seifer?
Mr. Chair, I haven't followed it close enough on the stadium issue, but I was thinking the S word is stadium, apparently. So thank you. I would say that if the local students are approving it, it probably does make a little more difference in terms of having them voted on themselves.
Representative Sean. Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First a question and then a comment. I don't want to open up another is it a fee or is it a tax debate. If we adopt this, could someone come along and say we're going to call it a tax? Or do you think this similar charge language would be incorporating local units of government calling it a tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, we believe that the language right now encompasses enough in terms of what Councilman Beninov had proposed that it would, no matter what you call it, where the intention of the legislature is that just for the sake of a student being a student or a college being a college, you just can't come along and assess them for the sake of being a college or for the sake of being a student, whether the word is tax or assess or fee or whatever.
Okay.
Representative Lanning.
You know, as a former college administrator, I can assure everyone that if a community were to impose a fee or a tax, that students would pay it. It's not going to come out of thin air. They're not going to collect it from donors to the institution. Students will pay it. And so that I wanted to clarify that. And then there's a common misperception that students don't contribute anything towards the services that are provided in the local community. Well, any community that has any kind of a municipal operation that has some of its proceeds put into the general fund of that municipality in lieu of tax, students are contributing. Cities that have municipal electric utility, oftentimes, most of the time, they're transferring some of those proceeds to the general fund in lieu of tax. A lot of other services that are provided, garbage service, and even municipal liquor stores. For those communities that have municipal liquor stores, if they're buying, they're helping to pay for some of the costs of that municipal service. So I just wanted to point that out, that it's not as if students aren't making some payments in lieu of tax. They are.
Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that tuition has gone up way too much over the past few years, and it's unfortunate. It is pricing people out, and I don't think that it's a good idea to charge additional fees to students. However, I am concerned, as you've noticed by the news, that there's been lots of stories about drinking incidences and students missing, and I do see the impact that that has on local communities and local units of government. And with the cuts that have happened in LGA, that has only compounded the problem. What about irresponsible behavior on the part of students or business owners in the community that contribute to the problem? I don't think that a small community can constantly enforce the drinking age, as you see with the University of Minnesota and the hockey students at the bar, and you've seen with other college campuses. So are there solutions out there? Do people have thoughts or ideas about how these problems should be taken care of? Because, frankly, I have a 16-year-old who's going to be going to college in a few years, and I, as a parent, am very concerned. We need to make certain that we're addressing these issues. And so if not by a fee, how? I'd like your thoughts about that.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, state of Minnesota has operated now for 150-odd years without having to go after college students. We've had drinking problems going back to my great-grandfather going to, you know, wherever it was some years ago. I don't think imposing a surcharge on students is going to solve the problem. Yes, there are some bad apples in the barrel, but by punishing all students for the irresponsible behavior of the few, I don't think is going to solve the problem. I see it as another cash cow for people to say, well, these guys don't vote very much. They're only going to live here a couple years. And what is $25 today is going to be $100 next year. It's going to be $200 the year after. And it'll get folded into the student fee statement, and it'll be a hidden assessment that it'll just be too easy for people to impose rather than making some of the prioritized decisions that, that maybe need to be made. So I guess I would say, you know, just do what you've been doing if you're a community. I mean, I live in Marshall. I live in the community. We have thousands of college students who live in my city of 13,000 people. And we've had a couple bad apples down there. We had a drive-by shooting last year at homecoming. That took some resources to take care of that. But to be honest, keeping our community safe, we've had two major fires at the university in the last couple of years. We had mutual aid, five departments there. And I didn't hear anyone in the community say, you know what, we should charge all those students $25 or $50 because they happen to be in our community. Most everybody finds them to be an asset to our community rather than a liability.
Mr. Chairman.
I was going to finish about my statement
with the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a comment. I believe that this issue has escalated due to the cuts that have happened in higher ed and due to the cuts in LGA. The more and more that we see these kinds of things happening, the more kinds of issues like this we're going to see coming before us. I think it's the wrong direction as well, but I think it's the state's responsibility to fund higher ed, and we're not doing a great job of that right now either. So, I'm finished.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to comment on the content of this bill, but I think maybe in a general sense of the kind of bills we're looking at, you know, this is clearly a city issue, and are we going to continue to nitpick policies that city institute that we as state legislators do not like? You know, we should leave that up to the city council members, and if the students do not like it, they could vote that person out. And that policy should be at the city level, and if you want to work on city policies, maybe we should become city council or mayor of those cities. So I don't think it's wise for our body to start nitpicking what policies we like or do not like from certain cities. So I think we're going kind of in the wrong direction here.
Any resident points?
Just a comment. Thanks for bringing the bill up. I think it's a great bill. They're devising all sorts of ways to skin the college kids. And I know of a college that wants to put a dome over a field, a new ice rink, and a whole bunch of things, and they just built a student center. And after kind of a ruckus about that, they withdrew that. But that was going to be part student fees and hanging over the head. If you want this, we want some of your fees. Well, then they abandoned that idea. In Minnesota State, Mankato, everywhere you go, every store you go, you're just throngs of college kids and donating their hard-earned dollar to the economy. The city is built around that college, and it's a shining star for us. And the last thing we want to do is discourage, you know, in this manner. It's just, it's too much of a burden to put on the kids, so I think it's a good bill. Thanks.
Representative Schroen.
Well, as somebody who's been in the higher ed business for 25 years, I really don't think that, from my observation, direct observation, that the types of problems we're talking about, with all due respect, Representative Hills, I don't think they're getting worse. As a matter of fact, I'm observing they're getting better. The students are actually, I find them to be more responsible, and I think maybe some of our education programs that are happening in terms of drug and alcohol in our grade schools and our high schools is actually working, because I've observed that students are actually exhibiting more responsible behavior. Now, is it as responsible as I'd like it to see, or any of the rest of us like to see? No. I'm not sure if we'd see these problems be any different in high school, in college, or not in college. I think it's a part of the growing up process, for right or for wrong, in America. So I don't know if, and I'm not so sure that these students weren't in a college, they weren't going to be putting the same type of burdens on the local support services that we have. So I would like to speak in favor of this bill. And just to further comment, I'd say that I'm very proud of this legislature. I've only been here now a little over a year, and I'm very proud of the hundreds of millions of dollars we've put into our higher education system. Very proud of that accomplishment.
Further discussion on the bill? Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the only point that I want to make is that is this a more global issue between state funds and local funds, and where we should basically focus? Should we keep the state and the cities apart, or do we want to continue to mandate more state dollars or mandate more state control over the issue? So I'm on the local government side. As much as I am in favor of our university system and higher education, I do feel that it's a bigger issue.
Mr. Chair, one thing I would point out is that, you know, the three of the people who spoke out in favor of the bill are mayors, Mayor Lanning, Mayor Hosh, Mayor Marquardt. As I said, we oftentimes pick and choose where we worship at the altar of local control. If it's something we agree with or we can see happening, then we're all for local control. But if it's not something we agree with, you know, we have the state involved in an immense lot of things. Whether we think it's right or we think it's wrong is oftentimes where the standard comes in. A lot of people say, for example, we should have a statewide smoking ban. Others say, nope, that's up to local communities. Some people say, well, we should not have the cities involved in the sales tax issue. And others say, well, we have to have a referendum first. And others say the legislature has to be involved in that. But, you know, we have a law right now that doesn't allow a local option income tax in Minnesota. A city can't just go ahead and have a local option income tax like New York has, where New York City has a much higher local income tax rate added on to your state income tax or federal income tax. So if we want to be pure, there is nobody here that's a purist. I'm not a purist. I know a lot of people who aren't. I mean, are we going to just, if we're up for local control, we would never be for any of the mandates or impositions that this legislature deals with, nor would we be for any of the preclusions that we have in statute as well. Whether it's gun control, which is another thing that we preclude local governments from getting involved with, or a myriad of other things. We have basically the option as state lawmakers to say, is this something that we think should be going on in the state of Minnesota or not? And I don't think it should be something that we allow. Once that cat and that genie's out of the bottle, or that cat is out of the bag, or that horse is out of the barn, we're never going to get it back in again. One more metaphor. it will be out of control, and as I said, it is a hidden tax that we will see cities just coming back to the well over and over again because it's an easy group to go after. I think everybody knows how politics works, that probably 99% of college students do not even know who their city councilmen are. I don't even know if they know who we are. But you know, the bottom line is I just don't think it's the right philosophy for us as a state to have.
They're purists. They know who we are. What's that wrong?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote on this.
Roll call vote being requested. There will be a roll call vote. Any further discussion on the motion?
For all my students who live in Mr. Paymer's district.
Bring them on.
I will now.
Okay, that's enough. Any further discussion? I renew my motion that House Bill 3169 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Higher Education Policy Committee. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Lanning.
Yes.
Lanning votes aye. Shulong.
Aye.
Shulong votes aye. Cornish.
Aye.
Cornish votes aye. Grafflo.
Yes.
Grafflo votes aye. Hilstrom.
Aye.
Hilstrom votes aye. Holbert.
Yes.
Holbert votes aye. Hornstein.
Aye.
Hornstein votes aye. Hosh.
Aye.
Hosh votes aye. Winchesky.
Aye.
Winchesky votes aye. Marquardt.
Aye.
Marquardt votes aye. Paymar.
No.
Paymar votes nay. Peterson.
Yes.
Peterson votes aye. Poppy.
Aye.
Poppy votes aye. Samuelson. Samuelson votes no. Scalzi.
Aye.
Scalzi votes aye. Tao.
No.
Tao votes no. Wardlow.
Aye.
Wardlow votes aye. Olson.
Aye.
Olson votes aye. Thanks for having me.
Hi,
Dean, 15 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails, the bill is passed and will be sent to the Higher Education Policy Committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Seifert and Mr. Bent.
Thanks
for letting us. Thank you, members. This goes to you. Next, we have House File 3079. The chair moves that House File 3079 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee. Now, I understand that there was an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment just to recodify where this would go in essence. And when I explain the bill, Mr. Chairman, I think that you'll understand the amendment. The page is passing it out.
Okay.
First,
Representative Abrams, just for the committee, the amendment was brought to me, and I noted it wouldn't be anything of a controversial nature, and I'm asking members if you just waive the 24-hour rule, and if there's no objections, we'll do that, but just give you a chance to look at it. To the bill, Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, first, thank you very much for the opportunity to present House File 3079 to the Local Government Committee. House File 3079 deals with the Municipal Tort Liability Statute, and let me try to bring some clarity to what the issue is. We currently have a tort law statute that limits claims to $300,000 for an individual claim and $1 million for claims arising out of a single occurrence. What occurs is that occasionally local units of government get together, as we have all tried as legislators to do, to try to enter into joint agreements of various sorts for the operations of various facilities. Such an event occurred in the Crookston area, where the city and the school district had operated under a joint powers board rather than an agreement, a swimming pool, and a boiler repairman was severely injured. There was a case in the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, Reimer versus the City of Crookston, in which the court sits trying to interpret Minnesota law, in which they said, no, there isn't a single liability, and in which they said, no, there isn't a single liability under these unique circumstances. There are, in fact, stack liabilities. I'm not saying if the court was right or if the court was wrong in that decision, but what House File 3079 does, in essence, is say that you don't have to come to the legislature to become an entity, a governmental entity. You don't have to enter into a formal joint powers agreement, because sometimes that is a little bit uncomfortable. You can go ahead and be under a single liability limit. For those who know my voting history, I have not voted for the joint and several in the past. I am not one who is out to bash trial lawyers or to bash people who want to have access to the courts as plaintiffs in product liability cases. But I think that when you take a look at the facts of this case, there is a public policy question which is asked, which is, does the Municipal Tort Liability Statute apply to circumstances in which two or more governmental entities are getting together or not? I come out in favor of the idea that there ought to be a single tort limit in those circumstances, and that's what House File 3079 is intended to do. I do have a testifier, Mr. Chairman, when you want to take testimony.
That'd be just fine. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to thank Representative Abrams for authoring this particular piece of legislation, because really what the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals decision did in the Reimer matter is created a tremendous
disincentives for local governments to work together to try to accomplish things that sometimes they need to do cooperatively. What we have is a situation where the city and school were operating in a pool and doing it in a good way. They could have just been easily operated as one entity. Many cities operate swimming pools. In this case, the city was had the facility, the school district had the maintenance of the facility, and just because they were working together, the court said you get two times the limits. We have countless cooperative efforts, example, drug task forces along those natures, where you may have 10 or more governmental entities working together. This Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals case basically would say that somebody injured as a result of a drug task force activity would be entitled to 10 times the tort limits. So I think this bill represents particularly good public policy, particularly at a time when we are in fact trying to encourage intergovernmental cooperation, not only among local units of government, but with the state as well.
Questions? Okay. See none? Mr. Yocum, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Yocum. I'm policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Abrams for carrying House File 3079. This is an extremely important issue for the Association of Minnesota Counties. Joint powers arrangements impact pretty much every aspect of county government, whether it's public safety, whether it's corrections, whether it's public health, human services, transit, transportation. We have joint powers agreements on every level of this. And I just can't emphasize enough that the Reward Court decision was not some obscure court decision. This has had very chilling effect on county governments across the state, local governments in general. Our annual conference was this last December, not too far after this case was decided, and this was the main topic of conversation. And folks were debating all 87 counties at our conference about whether or not they, first of all, should cease looking at any new joint powers arrangements, but also whether or not they should get out of their current or existing arrangements. They were just afraid of the liability. Specifically, I think one issue, I believe it's Maurer County in southern Minnesota, a very extensive methamphetamine drug task force. I do believe that they just dissolved that within the past several months for the fear of the liability that came out of the Reamer decision. And we're seeing at least conversations like that across the state. So this has had a very chilling effect, and we do urge your support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sue. What's your name?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sewell, attorney with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I think this is an example where obviously cities and townships and counties and schools are all working well together, and we hope that we can continue to do so. I'm just going to bring a slightly different perspective with some of the agreements that are out there, because the Crookston case that we've been discussing introduced the idea of joint venture, so it's not even necessarily locked into that form of joint powers, but anytime you get two entities trying to do anything together. We actually had some statutes, for example, in Chapter 164, the road statutes that we have to operate under, we are mandated to negotiate a maintenance agreement if you have a township road that splits jurisdictional lines. We have no option but to work together on that. But under the Crookston case, we could be looking at doubling our liability just because the road happens to be at a boundary line, where if it was completely within one entity, it'd still be subject to one cap. This law does not change the level of the caps in any way. It simply clarifies what we all thought had been the law prior to the Crookston decision, which was if we're working cooperatively as one entity, we should be subject to one tort cap. And so if you want to encourage continued cooperative efforts, including, I won't mention the word, but if you want us to continue working on orderly agreements and joint planning efforts, this bill would be an important one to pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schwab, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Olson. It's a pleasure to be here, and members, I want to start off by thanking Representative Abrams for his leadership on this issue. This, for the school districts across the state of Minnesota, are probably one of our premier issues, because we, out of all these agencies, work with different governmental units all throughout the day for kids, from crossing the street to mowing a baseball field. Sometimes it's done with a handshake that the city can use our baseball field if they mow it during the summer, to joint powers agreements, family services, collaboratives, other issues coming forward. What we're asking for is your support on this bill. It's key and integral to keep government working efficiently and effectively for the people of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Paymer?
I have a question if we're ready at that.
For the author?
Yes.
Okay, before we do, Representative Abram, has everybody had a chance to look at the amendment and that we weren't able to put in your packets earlier? Representative Abrams.
That is the amendment I would like on the bill.
Okay.
Chairman.
The chair will move that House File 3079 be amended with the A06-1182 amendment to get it in the order that the author would like it, to get the bill in the order the author would like it. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. So we're working off the delete everything amendment. Thank you. Representative Paymar, to the bill as amended.
Representative Abrams, just a hypothetical question here, just so I make sure that there's not some unintended consequences of what seems like a good bill. Let's say you had a city-county law enforcement arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Which is happening more and more. And you had a situation where a law enforcement officer might be considered negligent in handling it, bringing an inmate into custody, and the inmate died in a joint city-county facility. Under this bill, would, and they had obviously a joint powers agreement or... would the family be able to claim damages from both the city and the county, given they were two distinct roles, but let's say that the death happened in one of these facilities?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Abrams,
I believe under most of those circumstances around the state today, Representative Paymar, there would only be a single cap of $300,000 per incident or $1 million, $300,000 for an individual, $1 million for the incident. I believe that that is the current law under how most of these situations are currently handled, because it would be under a joint powers agreement or something that the tort liability statute currently handles. Where you run into a lot of problems is the incident that was raised earlier of having a baseball field that is owned by the school district, but they say to the city during the summer, if you mow the lawn, you can use it. There isn't necessarily a joint powers agreement with all the ramifications that would require. Let's say that the legislature doesn't do anything, Representative Paymar, under this circumstance. I would suspect that you're going to have a lot of bills and a lot of really long meetings in this committee creating all sorts of new governmental entities in order to fit into the single municipal tort liability statute that currently exists. There would have been a way for the city of Crookston and the Crookston School District to have avoided this, but it would have required a whole lot of hoops to have been jumped through in order to do so. I don't know if that's being totally responsive, Representative Paymer.
Mr. Chair, under my hypothetical situation, I'm not sure you answered the question, though. I mean, could not, under your bill, would the city not be responsible for damages as well as the county? I mean, you're saying that if they had that under the circumstances that I just described.
Let me give you a hypothetical in response to your hypothetical. Let's say that the inmate was roughed up by a city police officer and then was independently taken to a county-operated jail where there was negligent treatment.
Yes, that would be exactly the... Okay.
Under that hypothetical, I would say that there were two separate and distinct incidents. First, the roughing up by the municipal employee, and then second, the negligent treatment by the county. I would view those as two separate incidents. What this is getting to is a guy working on a boiler at a swimming pool in which the boiler explodes or whatever happened there, and the guy gets injured, and all of a sudden he's suing both the school district and the city and saying that I want the $300,000 from the city and an additional $300,000 from the school district. I would say under your hypothetical, Representative Paymer, there are two separate incidents, two separate acts of negligence under the circumstances that this bill is aimed to correct, I should say. There would be one incident.
One final question.
Representative Paymer.
Representative Abrams, is the trial lawyers taking a position on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I saw Mr. Carlson, who represents the trial lawyers, and he said he wants to spend some time with me in my office about it before civil law, and I would be very happy to meet with him. But they haven't formally said, we want this bill defeated, and hit the table as of yet.
Thank you. Further questions to the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3079 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Civil Law Committee. Mm-hmm. That was right. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill will be passed and sent to the Civil Law Committee as amended. Thank you, Representative Abrams. Excuse me, members.
What bill is
it? Deborah, where's Mike's office?
I don't know. He would know.
Okay.
Where's Mike Garrow?
Members, if you can hang on for a second, we're going after Reps of Yaros. Evidently, we're earlier than he expected. Twice tonight. And while we're waiting, members, if I could have your attention for a sec, I just want to highlight something from earlier on the eminent domain bill and the deadline for amendments. Representative Lanning was correct the other night late. It was a 5 o'clock time. We're going to stick to that. I'm not going to ask to change that, even though I know we've all been very flexible, and I appreciate that. But I'm going to appeal to you to try to get them in as soon as you can. And in the future, I'm not going to allow it to go till 5 o'clock because I want to make sure Mary has sufficient time to be able to copy and make them available to other members so she doesn't have to stay late. I'm appealing to members to just try to get there by 4 o'clock so she can handle that kind of stuff all at once. But we'll still go with the 5 o'clock deadline. And we've been lax on this if they're not controversial members and amendments. And even if they are, if the committee wants to take them, we have that prerogative. So it's not like a very difficult thing to overcome. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One suggestion would be members who can't get their amendments in until the 5 o'clock maybe could be requested to submit multiple copies of the amendments that Mary doesn't have to stay late to copy them.
Thank you. Very good suggestion. Everybody hear that?
What's the number?
The number? 30? Well, no. For the whole committee and testifiers, what do you do? 50? 50 amendments.
50?
Yep. So we can amend it. 4 o'clock, we copy. After that, you copy.
I copy that.
Any other discussion?
Can we go home?
Can he pass it and then debate it?
Good idea.
Haven't done it yet.
I agree with you.
It was here quite a while.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me,
Mr.
Chairman. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Yaros was here for most of the hearing. Not that I know anything about this issue, but I certainly would be happy to present it on his behalf if he isn't here.
Okay.
The will of the committee,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tamar.
Well, I don't know. I just.
You are a trouble.
Are you sure you want to do that? I mean, can we take it up maybe another time? I'm just wondering.
We can do that. We'll have a word here now. Okay. Couldn't find him, so let's do that. I know he has some. I know he's considering as to what he was going to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, I would hate for.
We can hold it over.
If there was some controversy that it gets voted down or something, that I don't think that would be. I wouldn't want that to happen to my bill as long as he has an opportunity to have it heard before
the
committee.
We wouldn't do that without him here.
Okay.
Right. And I was just joking with him when I told him I thought it looked like an Iron Range Met Council bill.
What? If it passes, it's good. If it doesn't pass, I won't hear it.
Could do that.
Okay. We can bring it up again. With that, thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.